Till we get through the report, because we want to get to recommendations. I'm afraid if we got bogged down on discussing the early points, we might not get to it. So if you agree, we'd like to make the presentation, then stay as long as the committee would like to answer questions.
All right, that's great. Chair Leader, I think you had a couple words to start off with.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I think just to reiterate what our charge was, we're actually here to determine not why the bridge collapsed, and I think you all understand that. We're trying to determine if there's some factors that we could recommend and adjust as far as the Department of Transportation policies and procedures goes, or where some changes should be made legislatively and also cooperatively. And I think that's our concern here, again, that we're not looking why the bridge collapsed, because as the gentleman will indicate, it's not in their purview. Normally that's being done by the National Transportation Study Board. So what we're doing is arriving at policies and procedures if there need to be recommendations and changes and where it can be done. I think that's about it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairman Leader. And we also want to welcome our new Commissioner Sorrell is here today, so thanks for stopping in. And I think with that, Mr. Stein, we're going to turn it over to you and let your team walk us through this report.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I am Robert Stein of the law firm of Gray Plant Moody, and with me at the presentation table to my immediate left is Bruce Moody, who for many years until last year was the managing partner of the firm and a lawyer with a general practice. Mr. Moody's left is Tom Johnson of the Gray Plant Moody firm, but many years served as county attorney for Hennepin County and was a nationally recognized county attorney for his leadership in a number of respects. To my right is Catherine, you may hear referred to as Katie Bergstrom, who is co-chair of the litigation department at Gray Plant Moody, and in that capacity has done a number of private investigations in the past. My own background, in addition to being with Gray Plant Moody for a number of years, was executive director of the American Bar Association, and for 15 years before that was dean of the law school at the University of Minnesota. We want to thank you for the opportunity to undertake this project for you. We think it is an important investigation, and we're happy to present this report to you. Let me say a word about the report and all the paper you have stacked around you. The report is the spiral-bound document, and we're going to go through that in detail today. And let me just give you some sense of where we're going with this. The first 30 pages or so are the background and context for the investigation, and we will quickly cover that and try to make clear what it was we looked at and what we didn't. Next, the report moves to some conclusions, and there are six conclusions that we reached that are set forth on pages 29 through 32. And then following that are what we describe as investigative summaries, you might say factual findings that we made based upon the documentation review that we had and the interviews that we took. And we'll go through those in some detail, because those establish the basis for the conclusions that were reached. Fourth, there are some observations about the leadership and the organization of the Department of Transportation that we want to share with you based on the interviews that we have had. And then finally in the report are our recommendations for possible legislative action, and a number of others are recommendations to you to engage in a dialogue with the Department of Transportation to address a number of areas where we think some improvement could be made in the preservation and maintenance of our bridge structure in the state. Now, the large stack of documents that you have are are the appendices. But before getting to those, let me just cover the addendums that are part of the report. I think you'll find these interesting. The first addendum behind tab A is the organizational chart of the Department of Transportation on August 1st of 2007, the day of the collapse. That's B. The first one, it really has...
The first one is a chart that we prepared that shows various parts of the Department of Transportation, both Central Bridge Office and the Metro District, and the boxes in yellow are the people that we interviewed as part of this report.
It's kind of a guide to our investigative path. B is the organizational chart for the department on August 1st of 2007. And you see organizational charts for various offices in the bridge office, the central bridge office, at that same time. Behind tab C, and you might find it necessary to flip back there from time to time during the report, it's a glossary of bridge terms. And I realize this committee deals with transportation, so you may all be familiar with them, but this is a summary of what is meant by terms that will be used. Then behind D is a diagram of the bridge showing the various spans and the gusset plates that have been identified by the NTSB as implicated in the collapse. Some pictures of the bridge as it existed prior to the collapse, and in fact pictures of the bridge on the day of the collapse. On behind tab E is a diagram showing exactly what the bridge condition of the bridge prior to the collapse. And behind that, material that was staged in on the center truss of the bridge at the time of the collapse. And then finally, in F is an index for the indexes. This shows you where you can find the documentation and the information we relied on for review. There are five volumes of the appendix, and they are, first of all, in the first volume, volume one, are transcripts, transcribed transcripts of all of the interviews that we did that were transcribed by a court reporter. Volumes two and three include all of the exhibits that were used in interviewing the various witnesses. So if you want to go back and trace what people actually said and what they were talking about, those will be set forth in volume two and three. Volume four are all of the inspection reports of the bridge. And then finally, volume five are other documents and records that are referred to in the report itself. As we speak, this material is being placed on a website. During the course of the morning, the report and all of the indexes will be placed on the website of this committee, so it will be accessible by the public and any interested person. And it will also be placed on the Gray Plant Moody website. On our website, the report itself will be placed with a link to the committee website to access the appendices. And the Gray Plant Moody website is gpmlaw.com, but the public can go either to the Gray Plant Moody website or the committee website. The team, just to go back one, that were the leaders in this investigation are the four of us at the table, but I want to mention some other people that were heavily involved in the work who are also in the room today. Attorney Greg Mertz did a good bit of the interviewing. Attorney Jeremy Johnson worked intensively on this project. Angela Elwin did a great deal of work in assembling the report. This had a massive software data process where information was put in and could be accessed at any time, and Leanne Olson and Cheryl Erickson were very involved in that whole process. So this was a large team effort to accomplish this task in about a little less than 5 months to bring this report to you today. So to get into the report itself, after beginning this effort in mid-September, with the holidays, quite frankly, around the 1st of January, got into it very heavily. We have reviewed about 24,000 records consisting of hundreds of thousands of pages, and those have been gone through quite carefully to see relevance to the maintenance of this particular bridge. Also, we did interviews with 33 employees of the Department of Transportation that were transcribed, and also some representatives of URS, which was a consultant for the department, and made their senior persons that were knowledgeable about the bridge available to us for interview. We also did 14 interviews, which were not transcribed by a court reporter, but were summarized in our own notes. And that included interviews with all of the living governors of Minnesota during the time of the life of this bridge. And that would be Wendell Anderson, Al Quie, and Arne Carlson. Unfortunately, Governor Ventura was out of the country during much of this time. Through his consul, he did offer to be available upon his return to Minnesota, which is right about now, so it wasn't time to interview him and include his observations in the report. We also interviewed all of the surviving commissioners of transportation during the existence of the Department of Transportation, beginning with Commissioner Richard Braun, who served as commissioner from 77 to 87, commissioner under both Governor Quie and Governor Perpich, Commissioner Len Levine, who served under Governor Perpich, Commissioner James Den, who served under Governor Carlson, Elwin Tinklenberg, who served as commissioner under Jesse Ventura, and we interviewed Lieutenant Governor Carol Molnau, who served as commissioner for many of the years of Governor Pawlenty's administration, and also had brief meetings with new commissioner Tom Sorrell, and we appreciate his courtesy and making himself available to us in his busy new time, as well as Mr. Robert McFarland, who served as acting commissioner for a period of time. We also had an interview with Governor Pawlenty, and his views are also recorded in the report, and we'll make reference to that as well. So with that, let me get into the background of the work. And it should be noted that we don't have the final report of the NTSB as to exactly why the bridge went down. We have their preliminary report where they say under-design gusset plates were a contributing factor in the collapse of the bridge. And so, to some extent, it was a challenge to do this investigation without knowing the eventual result. But we, one interesting comment made to us by a former commissioner of transportation, and all of them generally shared this view, is this collapse should not be viewed as an isolated event. It should be viewed as symptomatic of an aging infrastructure of our highway and bridge system. And so, to some extent, it serves as a tragic call to address the situation and see what needs to be done to ensure that we don't have a reoccurrence of this tragedy in future time. We think all of the things that we identify are areas where improvement can be made, and whether they were connected to the collapse of this particular bridge, we think improvement in these areas will ensure that we won't have similar tragedies affecting other bridges in the future. As we got into this large amount of data, our analysis really fell into four categories: information flow and decision making within the Department of Transportation. Where does safety information go? Who makes decisions as to what to do about it? Secondly, the organizational structure and staffing of the department, the extent to which consultants are used, how is the information received from consultants integrated with the ongoing operations of the department? A third, compliance with existing policy and best practices at critical times. One of the best ways to determine whether your policies are correct and whether you're following policies is to look at a crisis such as this and see what happened at critical times to determine whether improvements can be made in those areas. And then finally, we looked at the influence of state and federal funding considerations on operation of the department in the context of the collapse of the bridge. There were a number of restraints. Obviously, we don't have the NTSB final report yet. We want to thank the department for making people available, including the most senior people in the department. Some of the information couldn't be provided to us because of data practice considerations. Some involved matters that were being discussed with the National Traffic Safety Board. There was a tight timeline here. This was quite demanding to get this all done in this period of time, so that we couldn't go back and get two or three follow-up interviews with some witnesses. But we feel quite confident that the record amply demonstrates the findings and the conclusions that we're setting forth today, and we've tried to lay out a series of recommendations that we would consider a work plan for this committee to take up and decide whether or not you want to pursue any of these issues going forward in your own work. Relating to other studies, just making it clear, as Representative Leader pointed out, the NTSB study will tell us, hopefully later this year, what their determination of the actual cause of the collapse was. You also asked the legislative auditor to do an investigation relating to funding issues in the state, and you received that report from Mr. Nobles in February of this year. MnDOT also sought some explanations and assurances following the collapse. So MnDOT retained the firm of Wiss, Janney, Elsner, and Associates. And that's a report that will be issued, be a report that's given to MnDOT and presumably will be made public after the NTSB investigation is completed. Another project was the PB Americas project, a project that was instigated by MnDOT to review all bridges in the state, and those inspections were completed in 2007, and as a result, a critical deficiency log was established. A number of things have been happening within MnDOT. They have revised the bridge design manual to require independent peer review of major bridge designs. They've proposed increasing staffing levels for bridge inspection and maintenance responsibilities, and they have undertaken an examination of gusset plates following the NTSB preliminary report on existing truss bridges. And as you know, in just the last couple of months, they have closed the DeSoto Bridge in St. Cloud and closed lanes and placed weight restrictions on the Blatnick Bridge in Duluth. So we don't feel what we looked at duplicates those other areas. We carried out our commission from you to examine the department's policies and decision-making and practices in the area of bridge preservation and maintenance to provide you with information so that you can carry out your duties in overseeing this area. Now, let me go through the background and context quite rapidly. You are all well aware of this department formed in 1976. You know that it's large, 4,500 employees. You know that it has a broad mission. Should be emphasized again, we're looking at one part of this department in the bridge area, and we're looking at one particular bridge as a means of examining maintenance of bridges generally. And that's been put under a microscope to see how that is handled and how it was handled at a time when nobody expected a bridge to collapse. So there will be some areas where improvement is suggested. But I want to begin by noting that MnDOT has a reputation for high quality. It became clear in talking to former commissioners that they're proud of this department. It's been recognized nationally and even internationally as a leader in transportation agencies. And therefore, in Minnesota, we have a tradition of which we can be proud. And I think your effort to look into this area and see if we can be still better is a good indication of why Minnesota has been a leader in this area. Within the department, there is an Office of Bridges and Structures. You'll hear us refer to that, sometimes called Central Bridge, which is part of the central administration. And we'll get into the bifurcation between functions that are done by Central Bridge and work that is done in the district offices. In the metropolitan area and in Rochester, various functions are carried out in the district office rather than in the Central Bridge office. Bridge funding is referred to briefly. You had a very comprehensive report from the auditor, so we didn't go into that heavily, but a significant part of our examination was how do we handle so-called budget buster projects when something is so massive that needs to be done, it isn't anticipated in the budget. What sort of process should we have in the state for responding in an emergency situation such as that? There's a number of pages on bridge safety. I think we'll go into this fairly detailed fashion when we get into our findings and conclusions. We'll refer to the National Bridge Inspection Standards and the various numbers that are given for rating the quality of the bridge. Those are national standards. There also are Minnesota standards, which are adopted pursuant to statutory requirement. We'll talk about the inspection process, which is largely determined by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, ASHTO, has a manual suggesting how inspections should be done, and we'll be examining whether or not those requirements and those descriptions were followed. Obviously, an important part of this examination involves the inspection reports. The inspection reports are of two types, the annual reports, which are prepared for all bridges, and then the special reports for fracture critical reports, and each of them have their own requirements to be determined. And then finally we'll talk about maintenance issues the policy requires that maintenance and repair be done immediately when deficiencies rise to a level of critical deficiencies, and examine the connection between what is found in the inspection reports and what information gets delivered to the people that do this follow-up maintenance. The bridge, as I said, this is an investigation of one bridge as a proxy for other bridges. But it's not just any old bridge. It was the third busiest bridge in the state and the busiest bridge in the state that had the fracture critical design, a design that the state no longer uses and is not used frequently in other states as well. Obviously, fracture critical, meaning if one of the members fails, there's a danger of the entire bridge collapsing because there's no redundancy on this bridge. So we have in the center of our largest city this busy bridge, 140,000 vehicles a day, And I think the issue is important to see how was this bridge treated. We might not be able to treat every culvert around the state at the same level of detail, but certainly how we treated the busiest and critically placed bridge is a good study on our overall maintenance and repair of bridges. The bridge was designed in 1964, opened in 1967. It's had some major modifications. In 1977, the thickness of the concrete deck was increased from 6 to 8 inches, so a significant amount of weight was added at that time, and two additional lanes of traffic were opened on the bridge. Some issue has been speculation in the press about the added weight for those lanes. We discovered that it was, at the time of the design, anticipated that it might have 8 lanes eventually, so that was not inconsistent with the original design. In 1998, further modifications were made to the bridge, including the addition of that center divider, that very thick center divider, and the side barriers, as well as some other additions. In 1998, MnDOT discovered cracks in the approach spans of the bridge, and so to mitigate the growth of the cracks and prevent new cracks from forming, MnDOT applied steel plates to reinforce the cracked area and made some other modifications to increase the flexibility of the bridge. In 1999, an effort project was undertaken that was completed in 2000 to install a fully automated de-icer on the bridge. So that's the bridge, its construction history, and its modifications. It was inspected every 2 years until 1993, and then annually thereafter. And we'll get into the inspection detail in quite a bit of depth as we go through our findings. As we'll see, the bridge received a rating of 4, an NBI rating of 4 in 1990, and we'll get into that. So that being the case, it was subject to quite a bit of examination by the department in the ensuing 17 years, and some of the outside experts have very significant matters that will be implicated in our report. The University of Minnesota was retained in 1999 and did a study between 1999 to do a fatigue evaluation of the deck truss of the bridge. And that report concluded that fatigue cracking was not expected during the remaining useful life of the bridge. Of course, that didn't get into the issues dealing with the non-redundancy of the bridge, which was a separate concern of the department and ultimately a concern related to its collapse. A company called HNTB began a series of conversations with the department. HNTB is a consultant the department has used on other occasions. And HNTB made various proposals about alternatives that might be used to add redundancy to the bridge. And that's a very interesting series of memos that go back and forth. There never was a contract entered into with HNTB, but there is a line of dialogue and conversation that runs from 1998-99. And eventually, the department decided to issue an RFI, a request for information, and HNTB submitted a proposal to follow up on the proposals that they had earlier made, but they were not selected in connection with that RFI, but instead the URS Corporation was selected. URS had quite a bit of knowledge about the bridge because a senior person in URS is Don Fleming, who had been the state bridge engineer from 1986 to December 2000. And so he did bring that information to that. And we'll take you through the proposals that URS made and what was done about it. The URS produced a preliminary inspection report for MnDOT in June of 2003. Then in December, they signed a second contract, and URS gave a preliminary draft report to MnDOT in July of 2006, a revised preliminary report in December of 2006. Unfortunately, their final report never could be delivered because they were still working on it on the very day that the bridge went down. One other contractor that you'll be referenced in this report is a contractor named PCI. PCI was a paving contractor, a contractor that was doing the deck work on the bridge at the time of the collapse. And this was part of another project to upgrade Highway 35 from 94 all the way up to Stinson Boulevard. And one of the issues that we'll be talking about is connecting the information between these projects. URS had been doing very detailed work about staging weight on the bridge when work was going on, where the vulnerable points were, where weight displacement shouldn't occur. We found that none of that information was available to PCI, and so when they came through and did their work, obviously redirecting lanes and putting equipment and debris in certain parts, no studies had been done about the consequences of that, and it's possible that NTSB may find that weight placement and load distortion, in addition to the under-designed gusset plates, were important factors in the collapse of the bridge. So this raises issues about how do we integrate the work done by one consultant with work done by other consultants on other projects. So let me quickly go through the six conclusions that we hope to demonstrate to you with the findings that we will make. The first conclusion is that MnDOT policies were not followed in critical respects. Inspecting bridges is not an easy thing to do. We try to point that out in the report. A lot of it is visual, and it's very hard to see all of the things that you need to see. But in carrying out this very critical and important responsibility, certain things must be done. An inspector must record his or her observations with specificity. And that's the whole point of it. Put down in detail what you see so that you can get a timeline on the inspections. And it will show whether conditions have deteriorated from 1 year to the next or over a period of years. And correspondingly, the reports should indicate what action was taken in response to the inspector's findings that call for immediate and appropriate action. There needs to be documentation. I think MnDOT currently has this entire area under review at the present time. We agree that that should be done. We think it should be done with a sense of urgency, and we bring your attention to investigative summaries that we'll go through that will support that conclusion. A second conclusion is that decision-making within MnDOT was diffused and unclear. As I indicated, in the metro area, primary responsibility for inspecting, maintaining, repairing, and replacing the bridge rested with the district office, the metro district office. The most advanced expertise is in the central office. So there needs to be a very close coordination between those two offices in carrying out this work. As we talk to individuals that were involved at critical times and were on the bridge together, the testimony that we received indicates that the mission that they were involved was often unclear, at least inconsistent, as to what each person thought they were doing on the bridge at the time. And this lack of clarity in carrying forward bridge concerns is then exacerbated by the funding difficulties in figuring out where to get the funds to repair it. We'll see that one recommendation to spend $40,000, for example, to do a very critical test that wasn't done, unfortunately wasn't done because $40,000 was more than the district office could spend at that time, although the Central Bridge office would have easily had the opportunity to spend that kind of money. So there needs to be a clarification of the relationship between those two offices. And indeed, when we get to our recommendations, you'll see that we suggest the possible reorganization to eliminate some of this difficulty. Three financial considerations we believe did influence decision-making during the life of this bridge. Obviously, we had a bridge that was a concern for 17 years. It had a poor rating beginning in 1990. For 17 years, that rating never improved, although various modifications were done on that bridge. To a person, the department people asserted that funding would never compromise public safety, in their view, and we believe they were absolutely honest in making those statements, that they would not put funding ahead of safety. But it's a process that goes on over a number of years where you have to make a decision about alternatives that are presented in inspection reports, and sometimes it's easier to just take the least expensive alternative or commission another study rather than undertaking to take a more expensive constructive approach. We think the record demonstrates that there were occasions where these funding constraints did affect decisions that were made with regard to the bridge. And this issue is particularly true with what we call budget buster issues. That's a serious issue we have to face in Minnesota. What do we do when we find a major bridge has to be replaced or significantly modified? Fourth, the flow of information regarding the condition and safety of the bridge was informal and incomplete. And I think you heard some of this from the legislative auditor. I think MnDOT itself has said this is true. It certainly came through in our interviews. It's described as largely an oral culture. They talk to each other. And they share this information. The result is that written documentation is lacking in critical areas, and we can't be sure it reaches everybody in the loop based on one person talking to another person. It's especially a problem when you have departures from the department. There's been a significant downsizing in that department over the last 7 years, and particularly among engineers. We've got the percentages in here and the decrease in engineers since 2000. So if you have an oral culture and part of the culture goes out the door, then you don't have the documentation that you need to do to carry forward this work going forward. And so I believe the department is aware of this, but a much stronger effort must be made to ensure that critical information is well documented. Fifth, expert advice regarding the condition and safety of the bridge was not effectively utilized. I mentioned the issue with regard to the contractor at the time it collapsed not being aware of the URS work. I think there are some very significant issues here of integrating the various contractor reports to make sure that there's a coherent and consistent strategy with regard to a bridge, particularly a fracture-critical bridge of this crucial location. And then sixth, the organizational structure did not adequately address bridge conditions. There's the central office, Betrel District, which we think should be re-examined. But just generally, it's been a long time since they've had a major organizational review in that department. There's been a departure of a large number of employees, and it may be, and we think is demonstrated by some of the investigative summaries, ways in which a more effective response could be had. And we get into that also in our observations about the department organization and leadership. Well, Mr. Chair, with that background, then, what I'd like to do are to move into the various findings that we had, the investigative summaries, and Catherine Bergstrom will cover finding B1.
Ms. Bergstrom.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob. As Bob, Mr. Stein mentioned, this bridge was a fracture-critical bridge, and the first finding is that MnDOT did not follow its own policies with respect to reporting the deteriorating condition of the bridge. The evidence in this section is perhaps the most technical of the evidence we're going to present, and you may find yourself referring back to the glossary, which is at tab C here and there. Because it's a fracture-critical bridge, and because a failure of one member will cause the entire bridge to go down, it was important that the condition of this bridge be carefully monitored. Federal law and Minnesota's MnDOT's policies acknowledge this, and I'm happy to report that MnDOT had a good fracture-critical inspection guidelines. And MnDOT did something else well. It inspected this bridge more than it needed to under federal law. It determined that the condition of this bridge was in such a shape that frequent inspections were necessary. The inspection process we detail throughout the early portions of the report, teams of MnDOT inspectors from the Metro District would go out onto the bridge on an annual basis, sometimes with some expertise coming from Central Bridge, sometimes with some help from a maintenance crew. That team would get close up to the bridge on a fracture-critical inspection, take pictures, get it within arm's length, and then bring that information back to the office and generate a report. That report, though, was often not generated for 6 months. If anything critical was found on the bridge, a critical deficiency as defined by MnDOT's policies, that information would be dealt with immediately. There was no need to wait for a paper report to deal with that. And we found nothing to suggest that MnDOT's inspection policies and practices didn't, in fact, respond quite quickly to emergent critical deficiencies. But there are some problems with the inspection. And I should start by saying that inspection team would take the previous year's report with them. And they did another good thing. They changed the people who would look at this bridge, so there'd be fresh eyes out there. But those fresh eyes, the new team, sometimes some overlap, would take the inspection report with them and annotate it as they were out there so they could see how things would change from year to year. The problem, though, is that MnDOT's fracture-critical guidelines require a fair amount of specification in these reports. If you're going to have fresh eyes and fresh teams, they have to understand what the previous year's teams found. And so the policies and the guidelines at MnDOT say that we really have to quantify what it is they're seeing. And in particular, with a steel truss bridge, steel in Minnesota rusts. And rust can cause a technical term section loss. And section loss is the loss of the strength of any part of the bridge that you're looking at. Section loss is more important in certain parts of the bridge than it is in other parts of the bridge. And section loss becomes very, very important depending on its location and how much there is of it. This is not an emergent situation. It's not an emergency. This happens over a period of time. And it's very important over that period of time to quantify that loss and see if things are getting worse. Unfortunately, MnDOT's inspection reports for the bridge didn't do a good job of quantifying that section loss and didn't capture various conditions on the bridge. These inspection reports would come back to MnDOT and were supposed to land on various desks so that people could take a look and determine what kind of action was necessary. They just didn't do that. The inspection reports, and they are in Volume 4, repeatedly refer to section loss. And so the inspectors out there were recognizing that the condition of the bridge was deteriorating because there was section loss. But without a quantification of that section loss, it's hard for the people back at either Central Bridge or the Metro District to know what to do about it. So that critical finding, as Mr. Stein mentioned, we believe that MnDOT has this under review. We believe that MnDOT is looking at enhancing its inspection implementation, I should say, because it's great that MnDOT has the policy, but the policy is only as good as the implementation, and we believe that corrective measures are underway now to address that.
Thank you, Catherine. I think also the inspection standards that are set forth require that there be a quantification of deficiencies so you can get a timeline and see whether things are worse in year five than they were in year one. Catherine, would you cover also the second one?
Perhaps hand in glove, the second investigative summary is that MnDOT did not adequately document the timely follow-up on the inspection report's findings. You'll see in our report that when the inspection reports were finalized, it's not exactly clear where they went. There's a policy as opposed to where the inspection reports were supposed to land, but they didn't routinely land on the desks of the people deciding what the maintenance projects were going to be. And there's no clear policy about how recommendations within the inspection reports were going to be implemented. This is a problem in part between the decentralized metro district, which is doing the inspections, and some bit of Central Bridge, which might be doing the maintenance, and then also the metro district maintenance engineers who are going to be doing the work. But there was inconsistencies on how that was treated, and there was no clear documentation on how to implement maintenance on the bridge. And frankly, there is no clear policy on how to document what maintenance was done on the bridge. So if that inspection team was taking out the previous year's report, they might see the same recommendations of maintenance and not have any idea whether, in fact, that maintenance was done or not unless they visibly saw that, in fact, it hadn't occurred. The legislative auditor's report remarked on this lack of documentation. I believe that MnDOT, again, is already addressing this, and so we'll hope to see better follow-through on both the maintenance work and documentation of that.
Mr. Chairman, the third investigative summary will be discussed by Mr. Tom Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair. The issue here is the fact that the bridge remained rated as a 4 or poor condition in the superstructure for 17 consecutive years. A couple bits of background. First, when you were talking about a bridge, we're talking about a deck, a superstructure which supports that deck, and then a substructure which is the portion of the bridge that's actually underwater supporting the superstructure. In this case, it was the superstructure that had a rating of 4. Now, the second piece of background information is what does a 4 represent? Well, the 4 comes out of the National Bridge Inventory Standards, and it is part of a rating system that goes from 0 to 9, with the range of 7 to 9 reflecting that the bridge is in good to excellent position or condition. 5 to 6 representing that the bridge is in fair to satisfactory position. 3 to 4 being the condition of this bridge, being serious to poor condition, and 0 to 2 being a failed condition to a critical condition. So within the definition of the NBI coding system, this bridge had a poor condition, which was rated as a 4, which means it was in poor condition. Now, the manual, bridge inspection manual that the department has developed, expands upon that definition. And it says that a rating of 4 means that the superstructure has advanced deterioration and that members may be significantly bent or misaligned, that connection failures may be imminent, or bearings may be severely restricted. The evidence here suggests that when the bridge was downrated in 1990 from the bridge superstructure was downrated from a 7 to 4 to a 4, that was primarily based on problems that were identified with the bearings that allow the bridge to have some flexibility to respond to changes in weight load, to changes in temperature. And we know this from both the inspection reports and from the testimony of the inspectors who were involved in inspecting the bridge. Now, clearly over the 17 years, there was work done that Mr. Stein has referred to on the bridge. This was a bridge that MnDOT would say received as much attention or more attention than other bridges in their system. And we were clearly able to see where certain repairs occurred because of the lack of documentation that Ms. Bergstrom referred to. In many other instances, however, it was difficult to ascertain whether some of the maintenance work that was being done was in response to inspection reports. But we do know that work was being done, but we also know that over that 17-year period that there was not sufficient work or the right work done to raise it from a 4 to a higher level, to a 5, which would have been fair, or a 6, which would have been satisfactory. What we also found it was that there was no definitive plan during those 17 years to raise that bridge condition from a 4 to a higher rating, and that continued to exist almost up, well, obviously up until the time that the bridge collapsed and was captured in a internal document by MnDOT in early 2007 when they were preliminarily recommending that the bridge have an overlay project that summer. And that memorandum reflects that, and it's quoted in the report, that this work does not address the poor rating of the superstructure. Prior to final recommendation, a meeting will be scheduled to discuss future work needed to raise the condition rating above NBI 4. Now, the reasons why this bridge didn't over 17 years, that work wasn't done on the bridge over those 17 years to improve it to a higher condition, has a number of reasons. We believe that in part those reasons were financial considerations that Bruce Moody is going to get into in a moment. But let me just conclude by saying here that I think the issue, or we think the issue that this raises for the legislature to consider, is do you want to have a bridge that remains in a poor condition over 17 years? The department has set performance targets for all bridges across the state, and that's certainly a commendable thing to do and to have. For bridges within the state, no more than 2% of the bridges are to be in a poor condition. But it does not account for, and I think what you need to think about, is it does not account for what is the composition of the bridges that are rated in that poor condition or 2%. Is it acceptable to have one bridge or a number of bridges that are remaining in that 2% from year to year without having a definitive plan as to either repair it or replace it? I would note that within the metropolitan area, while the target is 2%, the number has been running in poor condition. The target, that number of actual bridges in that condition is running at about 6%. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to expand on that a little bit, you have this third busiest bridge in the state, critical to the 35W structure, downtown Minneapolis, rated in this poor condition all through this period of time. Until the study started to be done, the former commissioners of transportation said they were unaware of particular problems on the 35W bridge. It suddenly does when during the period of Mr. Den and then Mr. Tinklenberg's administration, they become aware of it. But the issue is, how do we surface a bridge in this kind of a condition to bring it to a higher condition? Obviously, all bridges are important. We can't say that loss of any life is worse in one area than another. But when so many lives are threatened by a particular bridge, so many people passing by, we think that some process needs to be developed to raise up to public policy decision makers this condition to see whether something should be done. So one of our recommendations that we'll get into is to suggest you get a report each year about bridges that are rated in this condition and ask for what is the plan to address those. Catherine Bergstrom will cover investigative summary 4.
Thank you.
Ms. Bergstrom.
Our investigative summary 4 is that MnDOT did not conduct a load ratings analysis in response to the bridge's deteriorating condition. A load rating on the bridge is an effort to determine what kind of live load, traffic, that is, the bridge can handle, either based on its design, original design, and its condition. If a bridge is re-rated and found that its design or its condition has changed since its inception, then the result of that is a posting for that bridge. And the posting comes in the form of a restriction. That restriction either is restricting the type of vehicles due to their weight or sometimes restricting the number of vehicles by closing a lane. A re-rating can occur for a bridge either as a result of a modification that gets made to it. For instance, on this bridge, the adding of the cement medians in 1998. Or a re-rating analysis can occur as a result of the deteriorating condition of a bridge. This bridge was re-rated twice, first in 1977 when the deck overlay was increased, and again in 1998 when the medians were added and some other things. But this bridge was never re-rated due to its deteriorating condition. We found no formal policies at MnDOT to address when an inspection team or even who necessarily should refer a bridge to the re-rating office in Central Bridge to have it re-rated. AASHTO's standards are clear that on an annual basis as part of the inspection, there should be a re-rating analysis. And you look at the bridge file in order to do that. That's difficult here because of some of the things we've already talked about. First of all, this bridge's file was in no one place. Some of it was at the Metro District. Some of it was at Central Bridge. This bridge's file was incomplete. If somebody was doing a review to see if this bridge should be re-rated based on section loss, that section loss wasn't quantified in the inspection reports. If somebody was looking at whether certain maintenance had been done, they couldn't find that information either. And of course it begs the question, we don't know what a re-rating analysis might have found. The re-rating analysis might have found that the live load was perfectly appropriate. It might have found something different. And we're careful, I think, not to let hindsight guide the conclusions. But as Mr. Johnson was saying, it's instructive. If we're missing these policies, and we could do better here, and so that we could be looking at which bridges ought to be posted, which bridges ought to be restricted, I think that we'd find that we would reduce the risks on busy bridge and maybe get bridges treatment that they need more quickly.
I think to put it in, Mr. Chairman, to put it in some kind of context, if a barge hits a bridge and does some physical damage, it's an obvious time to look at re-rating and maybe have some load restrictions. But if you have a process of deterioration that occurs over a period of time, you don't have an event that stimulates that kind of decision-making, and we need to find a way to make sure that that action gets done. In speaking with Mr. Braun, Commissioner Braun, about his decision to close the High Bridge, it sounded eerily similar to some of the things about 35W. He said year after year the reports came in, said this is a terrible bridge, spindle bridge, but it's no worse than it was the year before. And so this went on and on. So he just finally decided personally to close it. But that was an individual decision to do that. Otherwise, the bureaucratic process doesn't invite a hard decision along a period of gradual deterioration of a bridge. And I think that's an area that needs to be examined, not to develop a new policy, but to how better enforce the policies that are already there. On the fifth investigative finding, it deals with the gusset plates that have received so much attention, and Mr. Bruce Moody will address that.
Mr. Moody.
Chairman, the fifth conclusion of finding is that MnDOT did not document the bowed gusset plate on the bridge. This issue kind of came to the fore, if you will, in March of 2008 when the Minneapolis Star Tribune published a photograph that was taken in 2003 by URS that appeared to show a bowed gusset plate. Although that photograph was part of the documentation that URS would have given to MnDOT in connection with their consultations with MnDOT, that no one at MnDOT or anybody at URS really noticed the bowling that was present in that photograph. And nor is that bowling present in any noticed and documented in any of the inspection reports that followed 2003. So then you might say to yourself, well, how would they have noticed such a thing? These gusset plates are large. They're not just small things. And so if you're looking at one of those, whether or not it's bowed is not something that you necessarily would see just by looking with the naked eye. And so one of the things that can be done is to bring along a straight edge to then put that against the gusset plate to see if, in fact, there is any bowing that has been present. And of the inspectors that were working on this bridge, we had varying testimony as to whether they, in fact, did inspect for bowing in gusset plates during this time period. One said that he did not recall that. Another said that if on gusset plates in general, that he would sight line and see if they were if he could determine if there was a bowing. And neither of these two inspectors noticed any bowing of the gusset plates on the bridge. The Metro District Bridge Inspection Engineer, however, stated that he did recall seeing that the gusset plate was bowed. And that he wasn't able to tell us exactly when it was or which one it was or who he was with in doing the inspection at that time that showed this bowing, but he recalls seeing it. And he concluded that the bowing was attributable to an original construction or fit-up. When you're building these bridges, it's not quite like some of us maybe are playing with Legos and other things that have come together perfectly. Sometimes there are adjustments with these bridges that have to be made, and there are some construction fit-up things that have to be done on the field. And he said that he determined that the bowing occurred during this construction fit-up period, and because that was the determination he made, he did not note it in his inspection report. There is some testimony that's at variance with that, though, that if somebody... So another inspector would have said that if they had noticed that kind of bowing, it would have for sure gone into the report because of the reasons that we've talked about before, that then if it were documented and you knew when it occurred, then you could follow up and analyze how it had, if at all, progressed during the subsequent years. And so none of this was noted in any of the inspection report, but it's also important probably to know that there are other original construction modifications that were noted in inspection reports. And so sometimes they were noted, but there was nothing on this gusset plate that was noted. Then, if you fast forward now to after the NTSB makes its preliminary findings that they have had about the gusset plate issue, I think MnDOT is to be commended for then beginning a systematic investigation of gusset plates around the state. And as part of that, as Mr. Stein spoke earlier, they looked at the DeSoto Bridge in St. Cloud for possible issues with the gusset plates. And although the inspection did not identify any significant corrosion issues at that time with the inspection, they did note that there was bowing of the gusset plates at that time. And then they ultimately, obviously, decided to close that one down. Then Wiss Janney, an expert that was brought in to look at it, also looked at those bowed gusset plates and said, again, that they thought those could be related to fit-up issues. And so, again, this concept of whether the bowing occurs as a result of just trying to put the thing together or it's for other reasons is an issue that can be part of just the process of building these bridges. And it's important to realize that just because it's bowing, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a problem. In hindsight, we now know, because of the actions that have been taken, that the under-designed features of these gusset plates, that they were thinner than they should have been is an issue. We also realize that Boeing of gusset plates, because of the actions that have been taken on the DeSoto one, is something that is important to look at to see what it is. So both Boeing and undersized are important things here. But again, this gets back to the prior discussion that we had, that the failure to document any Boeing is something that just should not be occurring, because we need to be able to track these conditions to decide whether they're continuing to grow or not.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to be very clear on this point. It would not have been possible for the inspectors to know that the gusset plates were underdesigned and thinner than they should be by virtue of their inspection. They would assume that gusset plates were of the obvious strength. The point that we're raising is there was a bowed condition that's revealed in photographs, and we didn't have documentation about it and whether or not there was any progression of that during the life of the bridge. To the department's credit, they have taken action with regard to other bridges where this bowing has been discovered. But even there within the department, there's debate about whether it was original construction that caused that bowing or deterioration. But obviously the decision, based on our horrific experience, is to err on the side of taking action to make sure we don't have another collapse. But gusset plates being implicated as they are, that really leads us to a situation of investigative finding number six, where if there was any one sign along the way where this might have been brought to the attention of people to make a corrective action with regard to gusset plates, it was the sag in the bridge in Grand River, Ohio. And so Bruce Moody will review our finding in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that area, MnDOT was not advised by the Federal Highway Administration about the sagging of a similarly designed Ohio bridge. And as we just talked about a moment before, the NTSB in this situation after the collapse of the 35W bridge did a very good job of sending out a preliminary recommendation to advise the public and to advise other state departments of transportation about the condition of undersized gusset plates so that people could take appropriate actions to look at those and decide what to do. Unfortunately, a similar warning was not done to departments of transportation around the country after the situation of the sagging of the bridge in Ohio that occurred in 1996. And on that day, there was a bridge painting contractor had parked a line of trucks and heavy equipment on the right-hand shoulder of that bridge in the Cleveland area, and a truck reportedly crossed the bridge in the lane, causing the gusset plates to fail. They brought in an engineering consultant to look at this, and it concluded that the gusset plates at the time of the failure were not adequate to support the design loads of the structure. And the FHWA also analyzed the failure and concluded that the design thickness of the original gusset plate was marginal at best, and its load-carrying capacity was further exacerbated by loss of thickness due to corrosion. The consultants went on to conclude that the gusset plates failed because the applied loads of the contractor's equipment and illegal load exceeded the actual capacity of the gusset plates. We are not here to tell you what we have not been looking at, nor are we in any way opining as to what caused this bridge to go down. But there is a scarily similar circumstances around this whole situation. And unfortunately, we as a country did not have the opportunity to learn from that experience in a way that may have allowed us to prevent something happening here with 35W. After that, Ohio did a really great job of starting to analyze the gusset plates around there. They had significant training programs that they developed, and they had policies and practices that they were implementing to try to make sure that they were really looking at this issue. And they made some changes, and those have been good changes. There was an article that was published then after sagging occurred in September of 1997 in the Civil Engineering magazine, and publication, I mean, and it and under the title The Grand Gusset Failure, and that article explored why the bridge went down, sagged, and focused on the contribution of the undersized and corroded gusset plates to the failure of on that bridge, and then talked about subsequent measures that Ohio had been doing. That article was in the MnDOT library, we found, but it was we aren't sure if it was circulated to people. We did not trace that down to see if it was something that they had had a chance to look at. And it's also important to know in this area that the URS group that was looking at this had also not been aware of this incident in Ohio. And so as we look at this whole situation, we feel that because there wasn't any dissemination by the federal government to MnDOT, that we can't conclude that MnDOT should have known about this occurrence. And of all the issues we looked at, though, as Bob just said a moment ago, this is probably the one that, in hindsight, is most upsetting, because had that occurred, it may have then allowed us to have all the great processes that MnDOT and others have taken now to look at gusset plates, and maybe if gusset plates is decided by the NTSB to be the reason this thing went down, that maybe that would have been discovered beforehand.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. So, Mr. Moody, what you're saying is the federal government failed to do their job.
Yeah. Well, what we're saying is that the federal government did not issue the same kinds of warnings that they did after this I-35 incident, bridge going down. And whether they are required to do that or not, you will see that one of the recommendations that we make at the end of this report is to suggest that there be very proactive steps taken to ensure that there are obligations to inform all state departments of transportation about developments that occur throughout the country on issues so that we all can learn from each other's situations.
Mr. Chairman, Ohio was educated by this experience. They call their Department of Transportation ODOT, and as a result of that, ODOT inspected all of their bridges for gusset plates at that point to see if there were similar weaknesses, and they became very aware of following failures in other states, and so they were educated by that unfortunate experience. We hope that and expect that with your leadership, Minnesota can be similarly educated by this experience. It is a terrible tragedy for the victims for this to occur. But out of this, some positive development can happen if it stimulates us to take corrective action, be more aware of problems that develop in other states, and that will be a recommendation we make. We now move into a finding that's a little bit, it'll be a lot of data to get through, but Mr. Tom Johnson will lead you through it, because the finding is that MnDOT did not effectively follow through on advice of its experts on the bridge. We have these series of consultants that brought in recommendations, and they would get up to a point and then sort of recycle back again. So Mr. Johnson will review that data.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the time frame that we're talking about now is from 1999 up to the time that the bridge collapsed. And I'm going to talk about the advice that MnDOT received from various experts, and what it did with that advice. Mr. Moody will then follow up and talk about the way in which we believe financial considerations affected that decision making. So let me start with what triggered the consultants being brought on. The first consultant was the University of Minnesota. It appears from the evidence that what triggered that occasion was the finding of fatigue cracking in the bridge in 1998. Now, that fatigue cracking was repaired, but there was a concern about whether or not additional fatigue cracking, which is little cracks that can form in members as a result of vehicles, particularly trucks going over the the bridge time and time again. And so there was a concern about that in 1998 and 1999. But there was also a concern about the fact that this was a non-redundant bridge, which meant that the design was such that if one of these critical members failed, that the entire bridge could come down. And there's clear evidence that the then bridge engineer, Don Fleming, was concerned about that, that individuals who were with the department then and are still with the department were concerned not just about fatigue cracking, but about redundancy when they went down this avenue with bringing in expert advice. When the University of Minnesota concluded its analysis, which was primarily a fatigue study, it gave the the department some good news, and that was that in their view, the university's view, that fatigue cracking would not or was not expected during the remaining life of the bridge. But yet, even at that point in time, there was still concern within MnDOT about, all right, that's good news, but you know, we still have some questions that we should be looking at here, both with respect to fatigue cracking, but more generally about the structural integrity of the bridge and its non-redundancy. So about this time, when they're meeting with the university, is the study with the university is coming to an end. They're also talking to people from HNT Corporation, and it's important to note that HNT Corporation was never put under contract by the department. But it is also clear from the record that there was some fairly extensive documentation that was submitted by HNTB Corporation over about a two-year period, that some of that was provided at the request of the department, and the department was providing documents, including design plans, to HNTB to help it think through what some proposal recommendations could be and what a specific proposal could be. This did culminate in a proposal that HNTB submitted in October of 2001, and at that point in time, they were actually partnered with Dr. Dexter, who was the professor at the university who had done the initial study. And that proposal, I'm oversimplifying here, but that proposal had two basic components. One was to continue this structural analysis or fatigue evaluation piece of it, but a second piece was to do a structural integrity analysis. And that proposal makes reference to studying not just some of the critical members, but also the connections. And as a part of this investigation, we had discussions with the engineers that were involved in submitting that proposal about what did they mean about connections, and what they now say, and as a part of the record, is that when they were referring to connections, they were referring to gusset plates, and that the gusset plates were going to be a part of their analysis as to the structural integrity. That's known now. Whether it was a part of the discussion when MnDOT was meeting with HNTB, there's a difference of opinion about it in the record. HNTB did not get the work. An RFI did go out, as been mentioned previously, and URS was retained. Their contract is really quite similar in most respects to what HNTB was proposing to do with respect to the bridge, with one critical exception, and that was it didn't contain the study of the structural integrity in the same way that was being presented by HNTB that would have included the connection or gusset plate analysis. It is also, though, clear that this study is for two purposes. It's to look at, you know, are we going to be subject to the fatigue? What can we do, fatigue cracking, and what can we do on an emergency basis if fatigue cracks show up? But they were also looking at various ways to shore up the structural integrity of the building, of the bridge. And in the contract, it calls for URS to identify different scenarios by which it can install or replace the existing deck with what was called a continuous composite deck, which would be one very large continuous, as I envision it, slab of concrete that gets laid across all lanes of that bridge on in both directions as a way not just to give a driving surface, but also to help actually hold the bridge together in the event that a member collapsed. In a letter in March and then in a formal report in July of 2006, URS lays out its recommendations. There are threefold. Mr. Moody will touch upon them more directly, but they're recommending three things. One, retrofit, shore up these critical members with additional steel plating, put on a new deck, this continuous composite deck, and to do further inspecting. At a meeting in September, URS is told that we're not going to go ahead with the redecking option, that we've made a decision that we're going to put that off until sometime in the future with testimony that has it somewhere in the 2020 to 2022 age range, and that seems to be supported by the documents as well. So that option comes off the table. The MnDOT asks URS to do an additional study, what was called a fracture mechanics study. They do that. They come back with a recommendation in December saying, well, we do think that you can, if you do the right type of inspection, detect fatigue cracking in this bridge, because we think now that those cracks have to be of a certain critical size before they'll propagate to become a problem and take out a critical member. So that discussion occurs. URS actually comes in with a couple of price quotes for types of equipment to use in conducting that inspection, one of which was described as cutting edge, would have cost something less than $200,000. The exact price we weren't able to ascertain, but in that price range. URS, there's a difference in opinion as to what was supposed to happen after the decision was to go ahead with this additional testing. URS believes that it was going to be involved in that testing, that it was going to be actually out on the bridge, maybe doing it, or certainly partnered with MnDOT. MnDOT says, no, that was a misunderstanding. We never intended to have them come along with us. What we do know is that the recommendations that URS put on the table for a couple of different alternative technology approaches to the testing weren't utilized, but instead MnDOT did the testing with their own people using their own equipment. The testimony about whether or not that equipment was up to the task is, I would say, muddled. The conclusion of this is that this MnDOT testing gets called up short they go out in May of 2007, and it's called up short without completing all of the testing that they were intending to do because the bridge overlay work is beginning, and with the construction on the bridge, they can no longer do the continue with the inspection, and they plan to come back in September after the construction is done. Point that we concluded from here is that while there was some consistency in what MnDOT was looking for, starting out very strongly wanting to add redundancy and wanting to know how redundancy should be added, that over time the department began to focus more on the fatigue cracking aspect, less on adding redundancy to the bridge itself, and at the end of the day, redundancy didn't get added.
Mr. Chairman, that invites the investigative summary number 8. We worked very hard to examine whether funding considerations played any part in making decisions about these options, acting on these options that were being received. And so this is an area in which we have spent quite a bit of time going over the evidence and feel that the the data that was collected supports the finding that is set forth here, and Mr. Moody will talk about our conclusions about the impact of funding considerations on decision-making over this period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That summary says funding considerations influence decisions about the bridge. With all due respect to each of you, the bags under your eyes show that the idea that funding affects things because of you're trying to get things done at the end of a session is not news to you, nor is it news to people who have been in government and trying to figure out how to fund things since the date this bridge was constructed. So funding is obviously, from an overall standpoint, a very significant issue that you have to make decisions on and decide what you're going to do. We're going to talk about funding really in two different levels. One was kind of an overall feeling about funding at MnDOT, and then the second thing is we're going to take it to a time frame where some funding decisions were made to show first on a general basis what was going on and then on a more specific time frame what was going on. On the general side of things, it was very clear that funding was a challenge at MnDOT. And that some of the comments that we heard included, we have safety issues, we have capacity issues, we have aging pavement issues, we have bridge issues, we have traffic signal issues. I'm going to balance all those things out to say, here's what we think are the most important projects that we need to move forward. Another statement, it would be meaningless for me to contact central office and tell them how frequently I need more money because everybody could tell everybody how much more money we need. And then finally, from an emergency response standpoint, we essentially have to live within our means. We are given appropriation authority, and that's the budget we have to work with. In April of 2004, and then in 2005, the I-35 bridge was identified as one of these budget buster bridges that needed replacement or renovation in the next 10 years, with action to occur in 2012 in the case of the I-35W bridge. However, a bridge of this magnitude was a daunting financial challenge, and this was fully acknowledged in a February 8, 2008 report from the commissioner staff meeting where it was noted that major fracture critical bridge projects continue to be postponed due to funding. Now, as my colleague Tom Johnson just described, I'm now going to move into the specific time frame, which is right around the beginning of 2006. And as Tom thoroughly described, URS was studying that situation and was talking about redundancy. It was talking about the redecking and some of the retrofitting of some of the members on that bridge. And so the project, though, that had already been budgeted in 2006 was the overlay project. And so in order to get a project to move forward at MnDOT, they prepare what's called a preliminary recommendation worksheet, which sets forth what the project is going to be. And so in that preliminary worksheet, I think most appropriately, MnDOT noted something. And Mr. Johnson referred to that earlier, that not only did it describe what was going to be happening on the concrete overlay project, it also said at the end, this work does not address the poor rating of the superstructure. Prior to final recommendations, a meeting will be scheduled to discuss future work needed to raise the condition rating above NBI 4. And I think that MnDOT was at that time showing good judgment in raising that question, because in effect I think the question was, if we're going to put this $3.5 million into the bridge right now, should we be looking at any other things at this time? And especially when they've had the discussions from URS that's talked about a redecking option and adding some other things, it was most appropriate to be looking at that question. And so then they decided, and URS had sent them a memo at the end of March that again reiterated their recommendations about the need to be looking at the redecking and the other structural matters on the retrofit. And a meeting was then in fact scheduled for April 3rd at MnDOT to look at this situation. And as Tom talked about before, This deck replacement feature not only would have improved the structural redundancy issue that we talked about, but the memo that URS had sent also said that replacing the existing deck with one that was continuous throughout would decrease live stress loads by 20% in some critical fatigue-prone members. So it had both it had two components to it, and one of which was this redundancy feature. And so they meet in April, and they're going to talk now about the three investment strategies that are possible for this bridge. And again, most appropriate that they're looking at all the alternatives. The first was to go with this deck overlay scenario, which was already budgeted. They had the money for it, and they could proceed with that. The second option was to then look at a deck replacement scenario, and the third option was to look at a replacement of the entire bridge. The option of replacing the bridge was immediately ruled out, and the minutes from that meeting say MnDOT has not committed to funding this project in the next 20 years, and the $75 million or more estimated cost of the new project was cost prohibitive. So the third option of replacement was ruled out at that time. So then the MnDOT group then went about trying to figure out what do they do with these two other options that were under exploration. And the first option, the deck overlay scenario, would have then had replacing the top 2 inches of the bridge's deck in 2007, and that would cost, they thought, $3.5 million to do, already budgeted. Then they would replace the entire deck and strengthen the steel sometime between 2017 and 2022 at a cost of $15 million. Then after they had done those two things, they thought that that would allow that bridge to then not need to be replaced until sometime between 2057 and 2062. And again, that would have that something more than $75 million price tag. They listed pros and cons of this approach, and one of the pros that's listed in that meeting, in the meeting minutes, says that it would allow time to acquire the funds needed for the deck replacement. Then the deck replacement scenario also had components to it, and the first component was that they did have problems with the condition of the drivability of the deck, and that MnDOT had been patching that deck. And so this second scenario had a component where they would continue patching the existing deck until roughly 2012 at a cost of about $15,000 a year. Then they would replace the entire deck and strengthen these steel members also in 2012 for $15 million. And then again, they knew that would then only allow the bridge to last a certain length of time, and so then around 2052, the bridge would then have to be replaced. So then it's significant to note that this deck replacement work, the $13 million item that I just described, was not budgeted for at this time. It was not in a BIP. It wasn't in a STIP. And so that was a pool of money that was then not available. But to MnDOT's credit, they decided to continue to explore these options. And so what the memo then talks about is to really then make a choice between either just the deck overlay option or the deck replacement option, that it was then important to do testing to see what was the condition of the deck to decide which of these two options made most sense to do. And so the memo then of the minutes in 2004 in April say that to choose between these two options, a ground penetrating survey was needed to determine the actual integrity of the deck, which was in question. And the reason that it was in question is that they had done, MnDOT had done a radar survey of the deck in 1999, which had showed that 6% of the deck was unsound, and so they thought that it. So they were going to then talk about what's happened since 1996. Has the deck deteriorated more than that, or what's going on? And so the cost to have a private firm perform the radar survey was $40,000, as Bob had mentioned earlier. And the minutes also then say that the MnDOT could not conduct if MnDOT could not conduct the ground penetrating radar survey, there was an opportunity to substitute a chain survey, commonly called as a chain drag, which is really you drag a chain across the deck of the bridge and you listen to see if you hear anything acoustically that would cause you to wonder if there are something hollow or something below. And so in these minutes, it then says the ground penetrating radar survey, however, the chain drag was considered a last resort since the information from chaining is very inferior to the ground penetrating radar survey. So then in June, now 2 months later, the decision was made that they were not going to go forward with the better ground penetrating radar survey. And the reason that was given in the internal MnDOT memo of June 16, 2006 was that the ground penetrating radar survey was not completed due to funding. So then what was the consequence of that? They then decided to go ahead with decisions to overlay the bridge at this time instead of taking the deck replacement option. And so what happened by not doing the superior testing was that the full extent of the deck's subsurface deterioration was really not determined as well as it could have been. And once they got out on the deck to do the overlay project in 2007, they found that an inner portion of the deck was observed to be so deteriorated that an engineer from Central Bridge Office was asked to make a visual inspection. And that led to the determination to remove more than the planned 2 inches of the concrete deck in several locations. This decision also may well have deferred the redecking of the bridge. And the redecking it was an option that URS had been asking them to explore and had recommended to add redundancy to the bridge. The cost of redecking again was not in the budget at that time. And to MnDOT's credit, I've now told you that there was a $15 million to do both the deck replacement. And then, in effect, there was that had two parts. $13 million was for the deck replacement. $2 million of that was to add some other structural redundancy called a retrofit to some other members of the bridge. And to MnDOT's credit, they were then trying to figure out whether they should do this retrofitting project during the course of that summer. And although that retrofit was not in the BIP earlier, they did find money to say that they still could now have the retrofit of the members, not the replacement of the deck, but the members down below for the roughly $1.5 million. So they, MnDOT was able to find the money for the $1.5 million, which again I think was to their credit that they were working hard to try to do that. Ultimately, the retrofit was not done. As Tom described earlier, there were other recommendations to do other things to see if there was fatigue that would not to test that would not have required the retrofitting, but so that additional stability item was not provided on the bridge before it collapsed. Again, I think MnDOT seeking to find strategies for the major development with limited funding. Is a challenge, and it was a challenge. And MnDOT we give them credit for trying to look at what were the best options to do here, and they were operating under very difficult conditions to make some decisions. I'm going to digress from something, but I think it's also important to say they were also not unaware of some political and heat that they would get in public response they get if they were ever to close a bridge like that to do some of the deck replacements that are going on that would have been required in these things. And so they are, I think it would not be fair to understand the total context in which they're operating here and making a lot of these judgments. So unfortunately, it's our conclusion that funding consideration did defer work on the bridge in basically the three ways that we've described.
Chairman, I'm aware this has gone on at some length, but we wanted to hit the detail of this well to show the basis for these findings. The ninth and last of these investigative findings, Mr. Tom Johnson is going to cover. Hopefully we can go through this a little more quickly and then get to our observations about the department as a whole.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the ninth investigative summary relates to the placement of the construction material and equipment that was on the bridge at the time it collapsed on August 1st. This is of potential significance insofar as if it was that it may be a potential contributing factor in the bridge's collapse. We don't know that, but it has been studied by NTSB, and we have some of their preliminary findings. And based on that, we wanted to know what did MnDOT do in advance of that construction occurring to assure that there wasn't an unload or unbalancing of the bridge. If you look, when you have time, at the attachments behind Exhibit E or Addendum E, you'll see some nice schematics that the NTSB has provided that show where the vehicles were on the entire bridge and then where the vehicles were, as well as the construction material and equipment on the center span of the bridge. And there's also a chart behind Addendum E, or I guess the chart is in the materials here in the narrative, that shows that when you look just at the center span, there was roughly 700,000 pounds on that span at the time the bridge collapsed as sort of reconfigured by the NTSB. Of that 700,000 pounds, 570,000 of it, or roughly 82%, was accounted for by the construction materials and equipment, so a very significant portion. We also know from the NTSB's investigation that pilings of the aggregate, sand and gravel, were pushed up against the median of the bridge sometime after about 10 to 4 on the afternoon that the bridge collapsed at roughly 16. So that's what we know about the concentration of the materials and when they came to be there. How does that relate to MnDOT? Well, as you've previously heard, URS was looking at redecking the bridge, and prior to redecking it, they were given the task of figuring out how to put that new deck on so it didn't create an unbalancing of the bridge, and that with that, placement in the load on the bridge might cause it to collapse. So URS had that under study for some time, and were obviously communicating with MnDOT about that and what their conclusions were. When asked about this, the state bridge engineer said that, well, the study that URS was doing pertained to a deck replacement. That's the entire deck, 8 inches of concrete. It's not the 2-inch overlay. It's really not germane. So that's kind of where the evidence falls there. But what we do know is that study was never brought into the consideration regarding the design plans for the overlay project, where there's a process called the addition of or incorporation of special provisions into the design plans where load distribution considerations would be incorporated and made a part of the design plans, which then go out to the contract. It was not included there. The specifications manual that the department has does place a requirement on the contractor to not place a load on the bridge that would exceed the legal live load limit. So there is that restriction in the specification manual. The manual also says that additional restrictions with respect to load distribution may be placed in the contract with the contractor. Here, there were no additional restrictions in the contract. We also know that the bridge specialist who was responsible for monitoring the construction for MnDOT was unaware of the URS study of weight distribution. Of load unbalancing of the bridge, and did not have any discussions with the contractor regarding placement of materials or equipment on the bridge. What can we conclude from this? Well, we cannot conclude anything until we know more, until we have the NTSB determination for sure. When we look at this now, it's clear that we're looking at it in hindsight, but what we have found from this is that certain information that may or may not have been germane about that, but came out as a part of a study conducted by Central Bridge, did not get passed along either to the bridge design unit within Central Bridge or out to the Metro District engineers who were responsible for monitoring the construction.
Well, now, Mr. Chairman, let me briefly review our observations about MnDOT's leadership and organization. Some of these lead to our recommendations to you. One of the issues that had been raised in the last several months is whether some requirement should be established that the Commissioner of Transportation have professional engineering expertise. We raised that question with all of the former commissioners of transportation and all of the governors, and while I should say Governor Anderson didn't opine that much because it was so long ago, and MnDOT was just in the process of becoming formed at that point, but certainly very clearly Governor Carlson and Governor Quay felt that, along with all of the commissioners, that that is not an essential requirement for the person holding the office of commissioner. It was uncanny how consistent the comments were. They used slightly different words, but essentially they said that it be essential the commissioner be a good leader. All of them stressed a good manager. This is a very complex department to manage, and so someone that has management expertise should be the commissioner, and someone should be an advocate for the department within the state and within government. If that person happened to be an engineer, that would be a plus, but not an essential requirement. Then we asked, what about engineering expertise in the senior positions of the department? And all of the prior commissioners of transportation, with the exception prior to Lieutenant Governor Molnar, were in agreement that engineering expertise was essential in one of the top three positions in the department, either the commissioner, the deputy commissioner, or the assistant commissioner. And they felt that that was important for two reasons. One, to have it close at hand to the commissioner in making these critical decisions about, as we've seen, going ahead on life and death kinds of safety issues, but also felt it was important to have engineering expertise represented at the senior positions in the one of the senior positions of the department as a signal to the professional staff of the department that their views would be considered at the highest levels of the department and encourage them to bring forth their thoughts, whatever they may be. The Lieutenant Governor didn't agree with that and felt that if that engineering expertise was available in the executive management of the department, that was sufficient. And she noted that in the five operating divisions in the department at this time, that three of them were held by engineers and that one in particular might be relied on that. Now, Lieutenant Governor had Doug Difford as her deputy commissioner for all of the years up through 2006, but then when he departed, she concluded that the position was primarily a communications position, and so filled it with the person that she thought was the best communicator. The governor weighed in on this particular point himself, and agreed that there clearly should be engineering expertise easily available to the commissioner, but agreed with his lieutenant governor that it would be, if it were in the executive management closely by, that that would be sufficient. We conclude, based on reviewing all of the issues and the absolute consistency of all prior commissioners, that there is an important reason to have it represented in one of the three highest positions of the department, and a recommendation is made to you that that be done, not only to have it closely available to the commissioner, but to encourage the professionals in the department to come forward with their ideas, recognizing that there is someone with that same professional background who could accept those recommendations. It might be noted that in recent weeks, the developments have resulted in it now being represented in two of the three senior positions. Mr. Sorrell is a professional engineer, and as is the deputy commissioner who has been appointed. All of the governors and commissioners were of the view that if there is a good leadership team in the department, very rarely should decisions regarding bridge safety require involvement by the governor. And we found that consistently all the way through. The governor obviously has to handle political reactions that might happen from closing down a major bridge or putting load restrictions on it, but those decisions should be made within the department at the senior levels. The former commissioners and governors expressed an opinion about a state office holder being appointed as a commissioner, and the consistent view of every commissioner prior to lieutenant governor was that that would be a mistake to have an office holder hold that position. And it was stated in quite strong language. We've set forth just three of the statements that we took down verbatim, but there were others as well. This is a huge mistake that we expected to cause professional staff to hunker down and be reluctant to express professional judgment at variance with the political position of the person heading the department. So that was a consistent view. One of the former governors said that the Senate should share some of the responsibility for this because there is the power of confirmation, and that felt that the legislature should insist upon confirming an appointment and that there would be an opportunity to vote up and down in that situation. Obviously, we reached no conclusions on this issue, but we wanted to share with you the reactions we received from these individuals. These kinds of considerations can be determined when you hold confirmation hearings on future appointments of commissioners. We also view that it would be appropriate to take to ask the department to take a look at their organization. It's been a long time since there's been a thorough examination of the organization. Most of the reorganization occurs when somebody has retired or left, and the decision has to be made about where their reports should report under with that person no longer there. And we think it's time to take a look at that, particularly with the intensive review of operations and transportation that's occurring right now. There's been a substantial departure of staff, as indicated in the report. The number of employees has declined by 19% since fiscal year 2001. And particularly in the area of professional staff, engineers has declined by 16% since 2002. Our situation in Minnesota is not unique to Minnesota. There's a national problem right now of attracting enough engineers. And I think that's an issue where you should try to help the department find ways to solve this problem. Mr. Den said that in the late, Mr. Tinklenburg said that when he was commissioner between 1999 and 2003, they spent a lot of time looking at the projections of the potential retirements of senior engineers and where they would get replacements for them. So this was a problem that people saw was a long time in coming, but no examination of the overall organization of the department in light of this significant change has occurred. So we make a recommendation that you ask the department to undertake that review and provide a report back to you. And that might also include issues such as to what extent should we do outsourcing. There's been a great increase in outsourcing lately, and all of the former commissioners said outsourcing is appropriate. The only issue is what the balance should be and then how you handle the reports that you get from consultants to integrate it with the department's operations. We make several specific recommendations that provides an active role for the legislature. We recommend MnDOT develop a plan to ensure the retention of experts, senior management, and engineers in the department. We ask that you consider whether certain critical bridges should be subjected to special review because of their criticality in location and in vulnerability. The legislative auditor gave you a number of recommendations for better communication between the department and the legislature, and we recommend that you ask for an annual progress report from the department on the recommendations the auditor gave you as well as the recommendations that we give you. So going forward, you'll have a chance to see whether there's follow-up on the recommendations that come. Now, one specific issue in reorganization that we think you ought to encourage the department to look at closely is whether there should be greater centralization between the central bridge office and the district offices. There are a number of issues there that should be examined, and we set forth on pages 80 and 81 some of the benefits that we see that would come if there were greater centralization of that operation in the Central Bridge Office. And that, Mr. Chairman, then brings us to specific recommendations in the report. The first one, enacting specific laws, the 1A refers to the issue I raised of whether you should enact legislation requiring one of the senior one of the top three positions, one of the top four, actually, the fourth, I think, being personal secretary, but one of the other three offices to be held by an engineer. Secondly, to insert this language in the goal of the state transportation system, providing for the highest priority given to the repair replacement of fracture critical bridges rated in poor condition. Those are all, I think, potential tragedies that we want to avoid. And then amending 165.03. And I think for the most part, the first one, I think, is already accomplished in the regulations, if I'm not mistaken. But the second one deals with requiring the inclusion of a repair replacement plan for all bridges with fracture critical members that are rated in poor condition for two or more consecutive years in the annual bridge report prepared by county and municipal governments. So there'll be some notice that this condition exists. In the second area relating to appropriations, we think you should work with the department to try to develop a plan for how to handle emergency budget buster problems. I mean, we have to recognize that's intimidating to a department to know what to do when they're worried about a bridge and they don't have an idea where this kind of money would come from. You know, we get reports, well, I just fill out my report and send it in, and obviously they don't consider themselves ultimate decision makers on that kind of an issue. So I think that that's an issue that should be addressed, whether there should be some potential line of credit for bonding or some other process developed for what to do when that situation develops. Excuse me. I think we believe that there should be funding to support a plan for recruitment and retention of professionals. There's an issue there. We need to get engineers in that department, and and MnDOT's working on it, but they're not gaining on it. They're losing on it, on the problem. And then the 2C we think is quite important. It has sort of innocent-looking language, but we suggest that there be funding to allow MnDOT to hire a qualified auditing firm with expertise in this area to help them monitor whether they're following their policies. I think for the most part, the policies are there. There's some improvement in some areas that could be made, but the key thing is to ensure that carrying out this tough task, people document and do all the things that they're supposed to do. And this consulting audit compliance firm, I think, could help MnDOT improve in that area. Third, we think you should ensure that you're fully informed about, one, how bridge safety can – who can be the champions for bridge safety when there's such a demand for new construction going on all over? It's a – I don't need to tell this committee. There's a terrific tension there with the need to build more and more and more, and we've got this huge infrastructure that's aging and needs attention. And I think this is an issue that – we think that's an issue that you should give attention to. Secondly, you should be informed about the department's quality assurance plan and familiarize yourself with decision-making responsibilities in the department. And then third, the relationship between central administration and the Metro District office, particularly with regard to fraction-critical bridges. We feel that fracture critical bridges rated in poor condition should be subjected to greater scrutiny than other structures. Fourth and finally, we suggest that you ask the Federal Highway Administration to do a better job of sharing information like the Grand River SAG. That would have been critical, I think, if Minnesota had known that, because the situation is so similar. We recommend that you request MnDOT to review the procedures it follows in disseminating information about bridge safety, including internal dissemination of its own policies and manuals. We recommend that you ask MnDOT to submit an annual report to the governor and to you identifying all fracture-critical bridges in the state rated in poor condition, along with a specific plan for repairing or replacing each bridge. We just don't think we can allow fracture-critical bridges to be in poor condition for 17 years without a plan for doing anything about it. Two, summarizing the recommendations from consultants who have provided significant services on bridge safety and inspection matters during the year, with a status report on the department's implementation. We're getting all these reports from consultants, what is being done with them, and you could and should receive a report on that. And third, the report might summarize implementation of the recommendations in the legislative auditor's report as well. And then finally, we think it would be helpful for you to ask the department to review criteria for initiating load re-rating analyses in this situation of deterioration. It's just a problem. When do you act to take some action when it's just a gradual deterioration over a period of years as opposed to some kind of traumatic accident? So, Mr. Chairman, we apologize for taking the time that we did, but we wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to share with you all of these findings, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Well, Well, thank you very much. I think that you guys have done quite a job, and it looks like you've answered most of the questions that we posed to you initially. I think it might take us just a little bit of time to get through some of this material that you gave us. I know that I'm going to have questions in the future, and I was wondering if you would be willing to take some written questions at a later date and maybe help us, at least myself, get through a few of them.
I'm sure we would.
Okay. Representative Peterson, I think that you're first to go here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had several questions that evolved in my head as we were moving through, and now I guess you've answered several of them. But a couple of things that caught my attention and concern was when your first statement that when the contractor went on that bridge, that there did exist specific instructions from URS regarding weight placement on the bridge. And that then in your appendage D, I believe, it actually showed it. And yet PCI went on that bridge without that knowledge. And yet there were bridge inspectors who would inspect that from MnDOT, who were supposed to be the gatekeeper on that construction site. They were ignoring it too. So then the question in my mind, when I looked at the next report, which was appendage D, where you show the gusset plates L10 and L11 were the breaking point, can we conclude that those weight placement on the bridge, those gusset plates in particular that were under stress, they're all linked, and yet nobody seemed to know or nobody seemed to take responsibility? I find that hard to get my arms around.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, we are very carefully not advancing an opinion on what caused the collapse because there are experts that will do that, although there's been some indication that weight displacement may be a factor that the NTSB is looking at. But that's a highly it's a highly possible scenario that might have contributed to it. And yes, indeed, that weight was, as it turned out, tragically was placed in some very vulnerable places on that bridge for reasons that the contractor didn't have any reason to know. But our position is there was no connection between all of the analyses that URS was doing and then another project that came along to do repaving. Maybe Catherine can respond to this clearly. I believe the Central Bridge Office was invited to comment on that repair project, but didn't.
Yes, and I think that if you hearken back to the conclusion that the flow of information regarding the condition and safety of the bridge was informal and incomplete, I think that you'll find that URS's study of load restrictions and weights on the bridge was specifically in the area of a master redecking. And then you've got the overlay project, which is not a master redecking. Mm-hmm. The point is that Central Bridge has this knowledge. The Metro District Construction Office doesn't have that knowledge. The designer who's designing the overlay project doesn't have that knowledge. And they're not coming together in a way that could have mattered.
May I follow up?
Representative Peterson.
The other thing that caught my attention was I think you were being Minnesota nice when you talked about how the Ohio incident in 96, you cannot conclude that they should have known. I mean, there are only 50 state bridge departments in the country, and I know that professional organizations put out bookloads of information on when these things go. And I would suggest that when that happened in Ohio, there was a phenomenal amount of information going on. And maybe we can blame the federal people that they didn't notify us, but I can't believe that our engineers were asleep at the stick when that happened. And part of my concern is in the last 4 or 5 years, Mr. Chairman, we have seen four or five major banking institutions hit the dust because somebody in one of the trading departments or somewhere, somebody didn't do their job, and it brought them down. And I'm suggesting that lack of management and lack of identifying of red flags has darn near brought this department down. And somehow somebody had better pull this up short and get their act together with this department, because these are all linked. You know, this chummyism of not writing down reports, doing it all by verbal communication and not following up. If we were in the banking business and we were a bank in France or somewhere, we would have had the answer to stockholders, and I think we have the same responsibility here. On that statement, and I get off my pulpit, but you brought that to our attention, and I'm very appreciative that you had the ability to bring that out and give us a roadmap and a vertebrae, I hope, that will lead to a management conclusion at MnDOT. We'd better pull it together.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Moody.
I would only comment on that I did have a chance to talk with the new commissioner, and I would say that I was impressed by his desire to read, to get our report, to read the report, to see what can be done, and how we can make sure that policies and practices are in the condition that they want to do. He's got a lot of work in front of him, but I was impressed by his attitude of wanting to take our report and learn from it and see how we can improve. So I think that's an encouraging sign.
Thank you, Mr. Moody. And I know from my conversations with the commissioner that is the case. They want to move the department forward. And I think that we've got a management team in place now that will make the appropriate changes. Further questions, Representative Peterson?
No, I'm just stewing on some more.
Okay, Representative Earhart, and then Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the administration's first efforts at providing funding for transportation, roads and bridges, they advanced a plan that called for efficiencies in the department to pay for, partially at least, pay for the bonding program that was advanced, meaning to some degree that people were left to retire, eliminated, or whatever. Did you find throughout this there was a conscious effort to reduce staff to save money that have something to do with the 19% decline here? So were they letting attrition and other things of that nature take place with the engineering staff so that they could have the money to run the rest of their department is what I'm asking.
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I don't think we can conclude that. I think that the Commissioner Molnau, Lieutenant Governor Molnau, was attempting to respond to certain issues that she identified in talking with me that felt needed attention, that the department needed to be more efficient in what she described as deliverables, getting responses out to the various constituents that dealt with the department. So there was a plan that she had, but I don't think we have any information that would indicate that that there was a conscious attempt to diminish any departments that would affect quality for money-saving reasons. It was a fact that happened. This great decrease occurred during this period of time, but I don't think we could attribute motivation.
And
Mr. Moody.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Earhart,
I would also add that you can. I made mention to the bags under your eyes. You probably are seeing a few under our eyes too, and we've been at it for quite a while ourselves, and we export a whole lot of things. That is not an area that I think that we have really gone into to see what caused all of the changes, and whether it was attrition or it was other things. That just was not something that we can in any way say we've really looked into in an extensive way.
Mr. Johnson, did you have something to add?
Mr. Chair, just add to that, Representative Earhart, that in our analysis of it, these so-called budget buster bridges, which were being identified in presentations within the department back to 2004, really were a animal of their own in the sense of the challenge that they presented. And they were struggling mightily to come up with a proposal to deal with that. As you know, an implementation of what's called a statewide bridge preservation fund that does take some federal funding and pool that in the central bridge office or the central administration. And the transportation bill that was passed this session also requires some tiering of the bridges in terms of how to move forward, and that certainly will have an effect. The recommendation that remains in this report, though, which is still a strong one, which is the need to continue to provide for some centralized source of funding when a major bridge project replacement or major rehab work needs to be done on an emergency basis where it can't be worked into a plan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then there's no apparent reason for the reduction of 19% in staff over the past however many years here. Particularly the engineers, I guess. There doesn't seem to be any apparent reason.
Well, I don't know if that's a question, Mr. Chairman, but Representative Earhart, part of the reason for the departure of engineers is what I mentioned is part of a nationwide problem. The commissioners talked about it in interesting ways. They said engineers like to build. That's exciting to them. And so if we're going into an era where it's more repair and maintenance, that's not as big an attraction as when it's a big, big expansion time. So they think the positions perhaps have become less attractive. There's a suggestion that salary has a cap on it so that there are other opportunities in the private sector if they're very senior people to go into the private sector. And so this part of the problem is, I think, shared not only by Minnesota but with all the states. As to why the department in a whole was downsized in other areas, those obviously involve some management decisions that they could operate more efficiently in some other manner. And we didn't investigate the reasons why.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, we are aware of the department stated. Strategy for retiring the bonds did involve a savings within by administrative reductions, but we did not look, as has been stated here, what was that a precipitating or causal factor in the reductions? We know that it was stated that we were going to achieve some efficiencies. We did not have the time nor the wherewithal to examine whether or not there was a direct relationship.
Thank you.
Well, I think, Representative Earhart, I think we all know what's going on. I mean, you know, our professional engineers, and we've heard this in the conferences that we've been to and other, you know, from other states, and, you know, members of legislatures from other states, everybody's having the same problem. And we need to figure out how to better compensate our professional engineers. That's the bottom line in that area. I think the commissioner already has ideas, since he's an engineer. Senator Saltzman.
There. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking on page 83, and I'm very pleased to see that your first recommendation is that at least one of the four unclassified positions be a registered professional engineer. And just to note that this legislature did try to incorporate that, and in fact, we worked with MnDOT, and they were at least acknowledged that and approved of the language, but the governor had, you know, some reservations, and we failed to include that in our final policy bill. So I'm pleased to see that perhaps we can take another run at that, because I think it's very important. I want to thank Representative Morrill for working with me on that legislation this year. But I look to page 28, and one of the things that I noticed when we saw the Bode Gusset plate was URS apparently took the picture, and where were they between 2003 and when the bridge collapsed? And I noticed that that contract was renegotiated several times, renegotiated after a report was due. And I look at the amount that we have paid to URS, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in listening to your report, many recommendations were made. Did we listen to any of them? We were spending, you know, really at a time when, you know, budgets were tight, that we've had consultants. So I know that you've discussed this, you know, quite a bit through here, and we're trying to really digest this. But did we take anything from this? We had people all over this bridge in the years before it collapsed.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. $635,840.69. I think what Senator Saltzman is asking, did we do anything with that investment? Mr. Moody.
Mr. Chairman, MnDOT was obviously, as I was describing earlier, in that time period between April and probably September of 2006, getting consultation from different people, including URS. And they were making decisions. I would say that the department is not saying that they were not going to go forward with some of those things, that the value of the services that were being provided would have ultimately come about, but they had deferred some of the actions that were being recommended. Whether they were deferring it on the basis of some information that turned out to not be as strong as they would have liked, we presented our information on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it'd be fair to say that the state didn't receive anything from URS. They received reports that set out courses of action, but just the decision making process inhibited going forward on those actions. With regard to the pictures, they were turned over to Central Bridge and were in the file. It's just that people, I think the ones we talked to, either didn't recall seeing the pictures or certainly didn't attach any significance to it at the time.
Thank
Senator
Saltzman,
any?
I think that's enough.
I need to ask something about these gusset plates. What, you know, and you guys were talking about, you know, maybe they were put in already bent. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Okay.
The picture of the gusset plates came in the midst of our investigation, and we had the opportunity to talk to people who were out on the bridge. There seems to be conflicting evidence as to whether those gusset plates have been bowed since their inception or whether that was a condition as a result of the live loads over the bridge. That's not even consistent within MnDOT. But the idea is that they weren't bent when they were delivered, but there's a certain part of MnDOT that believes that the fit-up, in order to get it to go where it needed to go, resulted in a slight bowing. There are other engineers at MnDOT who would say that that couldn't be the case.
I would hope that that would not be the case.
Get a bigger hand.
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chairman, disagreement is too strong a word. Those different views, I think, continue really up until the present time. We obviously didn't look into the St. Cloud Bridge or the Duluth Bridge, but obviously the actions taken on those bridges were issues that came up as we were talking to people. And I think even within MnDOT, there's some feeling maybe on those bridges the gusset plates were bowed back in construction times rather than through deterioration. But, you know, right now MnDOT is resolving the benefit of the doubt the other way and I think appropriately taking action. So I think it's unclear. There's just no evidence whether or not they were bowed by making them fit back in 1967 when the bridge opened or not.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Moody?
We don't have a clear record in the inspection reports about it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm surprised that you haven't absorbed all of the footnotes in our report, too, at this point. But if
I'll get to it.
Yeah,
might be September 2025, but I'll get there.
Well, if it's at that time, you may have to ask for somebody other than me to answer your question. But if you go to footnote 218 on page 51, I think there's a description of some of the professional judgment that the bridge engineer was using when he looked at that. There are certain indications that they look at to see whether there's painting that's wrinkled or cracked or something to see if it shows any other evidences of stress. And so there are some things that they look at to try to make this analysis, and there is a certain amount of professional judgment that's involved. On the other hand, as we've continuously noted here, if you know that there's a condition that you have seen yourself that it's bowed, we believe that going forward that the prudent practice should be that is clearly indicated, it's measured, and so that then you can track it in a way that allows us to decide if there's anything else that's going on with that situation.
Mr. Moody, one thing it says in here is that the gusset plates are over-designed to include a safety factor. I think the NTSB is probably saying that that's not quite the case. And in that regard, I get this. There's a safety factor figured into just about everything, whether it's, a piece of regardless of what the piece of equipment is. But maybe you want to comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I think the comment that's made there is that I think part of it also is that a bunch of their training would have indicated that when they have gone through their engineering training, that gusset plates are generally over-designed like that, and so that's an assumption that they are making when they're looking at these things. And frankly, up until this time, that was an assumption that they necessarily hadn't had any reason to doubt. And so that, I think, is what they are saying. Again, I do raise the question of that Representative Peterson said that obviously there had been a situation before in Ohio, and if they'd had knowledge of that, maybe they would have been looking at it sooner.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, something that certainly leapt out at me, and I'm surprised I haven't picked up on this yet in all this time, but the fact that the superstructure had a rating of 4 for 17 years. Couple of clarifying questions. Was that attributable solely to the bearings, or is there any other aspect of the bridge that contributed to that?
Mr. Johnson.
A rating of 4.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dipple, that's what it's the condition of the bearings that first seems to have triggered the downgrading of the rating from a 7 to a 4 for the superstructure. But there were lots of contributing reasons over the years. At that, in a 1993 inspection report, for example, it's noted that there is some significant corrosion on one of the gusset plates. It was a line of corrosion of about 18 inches in length and up to 3/16 inch deep in a half-inch gusset plate. So that subsequently gets noted in future gusset plates in future inspection reports as section loss. So there's a lot of things that were going on, some of which were addressed, some of which weren't. The problem with the bearing number 6 or the bearing at pier number 6 was a really significant problem for them in terms of how to repair it without basically rebuilding the bridge, and they were stymied by that.
A couple of follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Was there ever, I can't picked up on this yet either. Was there ever determination at any, either a commonly held decision or a decision in any part of the agency that this rating of 4 in and of itself was unacceptable and we've got to do something to get that rating up to to three on this bridge? And then a follow-up to that is, would the redecking, that $13 million redecking that would have created some more integrity at least in that part of the bridge, which would have held it together, would that have changed the rating, that $13 million, I think, URS recommendation?
Ms. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, there are memos within MnDOT that we found that said that some of the work that was going to be done, including the overlay work, for instance, that was being done, would not address at all the superstructure issues of the four code, four condition code. There are intermittent statements by various engineers that, in fact, they have to address the four, and then some belief by certain engineers at MnDOT that if the code gets to a five, that's time to pay some attention to it. Set forth in Investigative Summary 8, I think, which Mr. Moody talked about, those are difficult decisions to address because you run into money problems, and in order to fix that condition code of four, you need some significant replacement, some significant work. Whether the redecking being discussed by URS would have changed the condition code of four, I don't think is something that we looked into nor the answer to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, I might just supplement Katie's response. At least in our discussions with MnDOT, it would have, in order to get beyond a four, at least, and this is not in the testimony because it's something that I would say that we were having a discussion about, but it seemed to me the conclusion that I came away with was that it would have taken it would have taken not only the removal and the replacement of that deck, but there would have been some other things that would have been required, too, to get it up to a five. To get it to a five was not a small financial undertaking.
Mr. Chair, Senator DeBell, I just finished by saying...
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, thank you. Just to restate, there was work being done on the bridge, and that was, in some cases, hard to track, but in other cases, quite clear that there was some, in instances, significant work. What we didn't find, however, was a definitive plan to address the condition rating.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble,
something that you said earlier, the year that it dropped from a 7 to a 4, what happened that year? 7 to 4. I mean, 7 is pretty good bridge. 4 is pretty bad bridge. What did something specific happen in that year, or did something get discovered that had been completely unobserved?
Mr. Johnson,
why such a dramatic drop so quickly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that isn't clear other than the pieces of information we have is that the change in the inspection report points to the problems with the bearings, and that's confirmed by at least one of, in fact, the lead inspector who was did not inspect the bridge that year, but soon thereafter was inspecting the bridge. That the primary reason was the bearings. There was a number of them that were corroded at that time, and one, this bearing at pier number 6, they were observing no motion, and that was considered to be a very serious issue, and the rating dropped.
Hmm. I see that Commissioner Sorrell's taken a few notes there. So, and Commissioner, just so you know, we're going to give you an opportunity, if you want, at the end of the meeting to give us a few of your thoughts, and then we'll have a meeting maybe in a couple, 3 or 4 weeks, and let you come forward with how MnDOT wants to respond to this portion of the report. And also kind of let us know how you're spending that $600 million of the of the leader amendment. So, Senator Dibble, anything further?
No, thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just wanted to thank the team that did this report, and what you've presented so far is work that we really needed to have done. But in our roles as representatives and senators, obviously we don't have the time and the capacity to review anywhere near 24,000 records or to complete those kind of interviews that you did. But having this information is so critical for us going forward as we try to determine what we can do to help make sure this doesn't happen again. And I think that you've given us a lot of very constructive information that I hope will be the beginning of a dialogue between the House and the Senate and the new commissioner about how all of us can work together to make MnDOT stronger. But I wanted to follow up a little bit on the issue of decision-making between the central bridge office and then the bridge offices that were outside of the central office. I'm wondering if it became clear to you which individual felt it was their responsibility to decide whether structural repairs had to be made or whether the bridge should be closed. Was that clearly a certain individual's role and responsibility at the central office? Was that out at the Metro District office? Or did you find an answer to that question?
Ms. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, just a way of a background, the Central Bridge office is a part of the main administration. It's not housed in the building right here by the Capitol. It's housed out in Oakdale, Minnesota. It is considered to be an expert and a service organization for the rest of the districts. Most of the decisions about bridges in the state emanate from the Central Bridge office. Except in certain respects, most of the maintenance work on bridges stay with the districts, for instance. All of the inspection of fracture-critical bridges are with the Central Bridge Office, except in the metro area and in the Rochester area. And those two, at the time they centralized the inspection, for some reason were accepted. Now, the fracture-critical inspectors, both in Rochester and in Metro, still use the Central Bridge Office as a service organization and their technical experts, and sometimes we'll have them come along. While there are policies at Central Bridge about what to do with these fracture-critical inspection reports once they come in, there's varied understanding amongst the people who are part of that policy what they're supposed to be doing with them. And so, for instance, in an outstate district, if there's a fracture-critical bridge, Central Bridge sends its unit out there. They do the inspection. They do the inspection report. They disseminate that around Central Bridge. In the metro district, the metro inspectors go out, review the fracture-critical bridge, do the inspection, write the report, send their report over to Central Bridge. Those fracture-critical reports get a different treatment at Central Bridge. They're not supposed to, but what we found is that they did somewhat. And so by decentralizing that fracture-critical inspection behavior, both in Metro and we didn't look at Rochester, you're kind of taking the bridge report and the condition of the bridge away from the Central Bridge office in part. Now, I will tell you that if outside of inspection, if in fact you need to get a plan for the bridge and you're going to use consultants, that goes back to Central Bridge. And one of the questions that we asked is, who was the advocate for this bridge? And I think the answer is they both are, and that is part of the problem, because that responsibility or that advocacy has been diffused.
Yes, Representative Hortman.
Then was it clear to you whether the people in the Metro District office or the people in the Central office felt that it was their responsibility to seek the funding to correct a problem? I mean, if the, first, they would, who, they would who say was supposed that, to decide, you mm-hmm. know, we got to do something? And then who was supposed to ask us for the money?
Ms. Bergstrom.
Representative Hortman, Mr. Chair, I think the plan to come up with a plan for the bridge, I think you would uniformly hear that that was going to be a joint decision. It was going to be the experts in Central Bridge working with the people who knew the bridge. For funding, you've heard the budget buster. There was not funding. And so there's not a clear path on how this money would have come together. It was clear that that money didn't exist at the district level as part of their STIP. It's also clear the Central Bridge didn't have that kind of money either.
Yeah, we, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Horton. We heard with some intensity and consistency that for the larger repair projects, once you get up into the sort of $5 million and above, that those presented a significant problem at the district level. And clearly by the time you got up into the $12 to $15 million, they viewed that as an expenditure that they just couldn't make as a repair to a
Budget Buster Bridge. And so they would say, we would at that point go to the fourth floor to look for money. And people at the, we have testimony from people at the fourth floor would say, well, they know the answer when they come to the fourth floor. The answer is no, you've got the money within your district, you find it there. So it was real clear that there was confusion around where the money would come from once you got to anything that was major.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman.
Yes, Mr. Moody.
I would only add to that, I think, as the just to follow up on the recommendation that Mr. Noble's made to your group, too, of ongoing dialogue, I think this is a subject that should have some dialogue around it, because I think you have to break it down by each particular item you're talking about of a bunch of a, of an expenditure. And some things are a decision at Metro, some are a decision at Central, and I think you need to figure out whether there sometimes is confusion as to who's in charge because of the different types of funding that are available to a project. And then if that project is then getting into a bigger project that's an ongoing overlay of longer distance, then you maybe have different people that are in a room. And so part of this, and then if you don't document everything and you've got an oral culture, then you've got even a bigger problem. And so your question is an absolutely wonderful question, and we're sorry we can't give you a clean answer as to who's ultimately responsible for each of these, because it's complicated by the different projects that are involved.
Representative Portman, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for coming here. I've learned a lot, and I've already gone through probably half of these, I think. I did find something in here that gives me a little bit of pause, because I have looked at a lot of the inspection reports, and one of the comments that I've made to folks is seeing the reuse of photographs and captions for sometimes it was many years. And then I happened to run across the comment here where it says that the U-10 photo was shot from the end. We don't shoot them that way. We don't take photos. Are the inspectors taking the photos? And did you find that these were photos that were given to them? And I see a corroborating statement here that there were a lot of photos that were turned over to MnDOT by URS. So what did you see where the nature of the origin of these photos are?
Ms. Bergstrom.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, Mr. Chair. There are varying kinds of inspections that take place. There's an annual inspection, which is different than a fracture critical inspection. And we did find that pictures are being taken in fracture critical inspections, because we have pictures of them, and there are a lot of pictures that are attached. I think one of the problems that we determine, and this follows on my comments about not quantifying section loss, is that sometimes the same pictures will be used. So, for instance, in the 2006 fracture critical inspection, there are pictures from 2004. And I think MnDOT's response to that is that it's the inspector's judgment at the time that the photo hasn't changed. And I think the criticism there is that that might be true to the eyes of the person who's out on the bridge, but it's not able, you can't discern that if you're back at Central Bridge or back in the Metro District looking at this and trying to quantify from that picture. So I think that when we're talking about consistencies and following policies, the documentation piece of it includes probably better picture taking as well as quantification.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I just would like to add one other thing to that. It's very important to keep in mind the time periods when these photographs were taken, too. Technology is improving here each and every day here in terms of what they have. And some of the people that are taking these photos, we have to remember, are way up above and trying to work through areas that have feces, are dark or dirty, there's everything. They're moving around to try to get pictures of things. Digital cameras have been a wonderful development here. And we talked earlier about the idea that these reports don't get sometimes made for 6 months. And I think one of the things that the dialogue would be a healthy thing for you to all talk about is what are some of the other technological things that other places places are doing so that you can get a timely recording of the information as the person is saying it, get the pictures that are all relevant, and do it in a way that works. And you know, they're climbing around in a lot of different ways, and they have a concern if they drop a laptop in a river and what happens. And so but there may be things that could be done technologically to help on these things so that we get timely and very clear photographs of the things that are most relevant.
Yeah, well, Representative, yes. Or Senator Carlson.
And related to that, there were several instances of, for instance, bolts broken or missing, and the photographs were repeated several years in a row. And what you're saying now is that that does represent what the inspectors were finding, which I suspected was true. Did you see a connection with a response to those, especially the bolts breaking? Why were they breaking? Was it tension, shear, fatigue? And were they replaced? And was someone noting that they had been replaced?
Ms. Bergstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, I think that our investigative summary number 2 addresses that, 1 and 2 together, actually, because I think that some of the MnDOT inspectors would say that it was not their responsibility to determine the whys of what they were finding, that they were supposed to be making reports, then working with other experts at MnDOT to make recommendations. But what we found was that how that information got to the people it needed to get to, and what follow-on maintenance was done, and then what follow-on maintenance was actually recorded, is what is part of this oral culture. And so it's really hard to tell, actually, from the inspection reports whether, in fact, the bolts were still missing. Sometimes they weren't, and sometimes they were, but that's not adequately documented. So I don't think we know the whys. I think the investigative summaries 1 and 2 will tell you that there are things that can be shored up there so that in the future that information would be passed on to the right people.
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair, another one that speed forward to what we were talking about a little while ago, the budget busters. How often would you run into them? And then if you ran into something that was determined to be a budget buster, was it missing from the forecasted maintenance or forecasted replacement? I mean, was this a surprise, or was it something that moved in the forecast or was completely missed in the forecast?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, the number of budget buster bridges that were on the list did vary over time, but one of the constants that you did see was that the time for action, that is either major renovation or replacement, was continually pushed out. And it's not as clear, you know, how that related to work filling in behind. You got some of that from Mr. Moody with respect to Investigative Summary 8, that there was work occurring, but as is work being planned, and as that was happening, the date for replacing the bridge was being pushed out. But we don't have a definitive answer in terms of, were they doing more or less work by way of maintenance or minor or major repair on any of these? Well, minor repair. We know major repair with respect to this bridge was relatively limited. But with minor repair, were they doing more because it was a budget buster bridge and it was going to be further out before they could get around to it? That's not clear, I don't think, from the record.
Senator Carlson, further questions?
That's all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I just want to add one more comment to what you were saying. Of course, we were only looking at this particular bridge, so we can't really say anything about what was happening on any other bridges and the funding of it. But what is fairly clear to me anyway in looking at this situation is that these conditions can change in a way that even though you have tried to plan in advance for what is coming up, if a condition changes, then it really can throw you into a problem situation because you have not budgeted a large amount of money that would be required to do this. And that is why we think in one of our recommendations here that having monies available for emergency unexpected repairs and also of a certain magnitude and also for these budget buster bridges that maybe have a condition that comes up quickly is a very important thing for you to examine to decide how you're going to fund it. Because if you get one of these unexpected things that comes up, there just isn't enough flex in the system right now to deal with that.
Thank you. I think that we did go a portion of the way to try to rectify some of that this past year. And, you know, it's a good thing that the person to my right has a little bit of experience in building bridges. So, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And again, and thank you for this excellent report. I think it raises some important and disturbing questions, obviously, about how financial considerations have played into decision-making, the flow of information. But one question I have, if you could address it, is this issue of the loss of staff, and particularly veteran staff over the years, this 19% decline. How has that affected decision-making at MnDOT, in your opinion? And did you pick up throughout your investigation any issues around morale that ought to be concerning to us? I think that, again, when we lose these veteran engineers and people with the institutional memory, maybe does that contribute to this, again, this informal, you know, not written down, documented kind of culture there? So if you could comment on that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Stein.
Chairman, Representative Hornstein, there were a number of people that we talked to that said morale was low, and so at least we concluded that that is a circumstance we have right now. We really didn't take our assignment to go into the department and see how decision making has changed. We think that's part of the review that we're suggesting you ask for. I think we've documented that improvement is needed in flow of information and clarifying decision making. But I think the next step would be to ask the department to seek some professional assistance in determining how most effectively to carry out each of their missions and in clarifying the processes by which information flows. But I think it did come through in quite a number of comments that there was low morale.
Ms. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Moody.
I'm fine with Bruce, too. That's fine.
Okay.
As a follow-up, I would just say that one of the things that we are talking about, a theme here, is better communication with everybody. And that's all the consultants, all the contractors. And another source that you have is the legislative auditor also gave you some work, some advice, and I see Deb is here in the audience, too, listening to this report. And they talked about some of this employment stuff. I have to tell you, I think there's another issue that you have on this side. And that is you have some very long-term employees that are in MnDOT who are very dedicated and have worked very hard for a long, long time. And so you've got, you know, we saw a bunch of people that have worked for just decades that are there too. So that you've got another issue not only in terms of attracting new talent, but you're going to have some potential retirements and other things that are coming up here with people that have been in very significant positions at that department that you're going to have to make sure that that's a planful event as well. And so the overall employment staffing structure is an important issue to be looked at.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have spent a lot of time with these MnDOT folks over the last 5 months. And I think that Bruce is right that you've got a lot of people who've spent their entire careers there and take pride in their job. I think we spent a lot of time talking anecdotally as we spent time in that building. And anecdotally, I would ask about morale. And I think that there is some of what Bob was referring to, which is they are primarily engineers, and they like to do engineering. And they feel somewhat that they have been gutted administratively. And engineers don't necessarily want to sit down and write a memo. They want to do engineering. And that if they had the proper administrative support, they would be able to get about the business of engineering better and have that infrastructure to support the paper trail that needs to be there. And following on another comment that Bob made, again, talking to a lot of engineers outside of MnDOT, there appears to be a certain amount of frustration with what's kind of known in the industry around departments of transportation as the outsourcing of design build, and that all of the engineering functions are going outside of the departments of transportation, leading the department engineers to be administrators, and it's not what they were hired to do. And so this outsourcing affects morale, too, because they don't find that they're being used to their highest and best use.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to comment before I ask a question.
Sure.
I think for the members of the committee and maybe the public that's here, for the process that we went through in selecting a firm to represent us, I think it hasn't been acknowledged or probably that aware. We went through a detailed process. It wasn't just, and I think Senator Murphy and myself originally as co-chairs weren't too enthralled about the idea of going through this process in the first place. But anyhow, I think we've seen some results, and I think we, with Gray Plant Moody, we actually didn't make a decision just from talking to her originally. We spent a couple of times with the members that were involved and going through all the, whatever you want to call it, interview process and looking at what you could do. And we tried to be as neutral as we can. And I think regardless of all of, we had seven firms. I believe we had seven or more. And we certainly looked at, they're all capable firms and they've done this work before, not done this particular type of work. I think it's new when you get in the area here. And I think to the Gray Plant Moody, I believe that you've also had some engineering consultants advise you in your process. So while they recognize as they are basically a group of attorneys that maybe this is outside their expertise as far as maybe not outside their expertise, but they were not here to determine, again, as I pointed out before, why the bridge collapsed. And I think based on, I actually am surprised at the amount of appendices and everything that you have backing up basically every statement you make. It's not just as you say, off the cuff. And I think you've got a basis for putting it in. And I think it's something we as a legislature certainly need because we can look at all things when everybody gets ideas, and I think we certainly will be addressing these conclusions and all the findings that you have because it does verify, I think, much of what all of us thought. And I think MnDOT will be a partner, and I think they're happy to see this, and I think that's going to be good for both MnDOT and the legislature. And again, of all the firms we had, you know, how do you start out? We're all on the same basis, and I think every firm certainly would have done a great job, and there's no doubt about it. You've done, magnificent job if you look at all the data, and I hope I go through that all sometime and do and take a good look at it. And again, thank you, gentlemen, for all that. My question is, one of the things that's bothered me as a legislator is the fact that the funding issue, and I think it's pretty predominant, a lot of this indirectly relates to funding. And I'd have to say, and I've always said it, that I think part of the problem with MnDOT has been the legislature. We've not provided the funding. Senator Murphy and practically all these people are supporters of funding. And we've not done the funding that we should have to the extent we have. And that really tied MnDOT's hands. And I think that's, as you pointed out with blockbusters, that's been a decision factor. The question I have then with dealing with all the commissioners, basically the ex-commissioners, not so much the governors, was there ever any indication to say how they were allowed or how they were able to advocate for funding? Because I think there's been a lack of advocacy, or people advocating for funding a number of years now. Has that been an issue or not?
Mr. Chairman and Chairman Leader, yes, that was a part of our discussion with the governors and the commissioners of transportation. Where do they see the funding coming from and what happened during their time? And this is not really a partisan issue. For example, Governor Cui mentioned that he proposed an increase in the gas tax when he was governor because his commissioner Braun had gone out and done a study. I think it was about 19, if I have my dates right, it would have been the late 70s, and said about 25 years from now there's going to be a huge need for expenditures in the maintenance and preservation area, and kabam, that's where we are right now. So Braun saw it back then, so Governor Cui proposed a 10-cent increase in the gas tax, which he said would be about a 43-cent increase right now if it had been enacted, and it was a Democratic legislature that said no. So it goes both ways. This is not a partisan issue. Where does the funding come from? They talked about the ones that Commissioner Levine had two increases during his time, and he talked about the coalition that he put together during that time to do that, and I think that was the last gas tax increase until this particular year. Commissioner Braun made a
Republican governor as well.
Yes. Commissioner Braun said an interesting thing in light of your dramatic increase in funding this year by an increase in the gas tax, is that, and he's a very astute man, incidentally. I was very impressed by Commissioner Braun, said that he thought the next commissioner would actually have more pressure on for funding, not less, because it's been understood in the state that there weren't many funds available, so people have been holding back their projects, and the availability of this funding is going to present a lot of demand. So I think all the more reason that this committee and the transportation committees of the legislature need to work closely with the department over this next period of time to see whether or not this large improvement will in fact enable the department to make some gains in this area of preservation of the infrastructure.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stein. I don't see any further questions here, and I just want to say thank you to you and your team. I haven't fully read the report or any of the work behind me. I look forward to it. And we're definitely going to strongly consider some of the recommendations that you've made. And as you can see, that we've already, as a legislature, started moving in that direction in several regards. I know that our new commissioner is chomping at the bit to get a good relationship built with the legislature and all the other folks who are involved in road construction and maintenance throughout the state, and I'm sure that we'll be having a lot of discussions with Mr. Sorrell on how we can work together to best implement a lot of your recommendations. And again, just for the public, and Chair Leader mentioned a portion of this, our committee's charge is not to come up with a reason as to why the bridge fell down. Our committee's charge is to come up with ways that we can make our bridge program better than any other bridge program in the world. I believe that we have a good bridge program, but it doesn't mean that it can't be better, and that's our charge, and we're going to continue to do that. So once again, thank you, and as I asked earlier, if I do have some more written questions, I'll submit them to you. And once again, thanks for your work, and you far exceeded our expectations.
Mr. Chairman, thank you and members of the committee for giving us this opportunity. As I said at our earlier hearing, this was a challenge to get this amount of work done in the just under 5 months that we had available. But we're very pleased that you received it, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks.
And the Oh, Mr. Sorrell, I'm sorry. If you would want to come to the table just briefly here.
So they see who he is.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tom.
Commissioner, thanks for being here today and sitting through this whole about 3.5 hours worth of affair here.
Happy to be here, and Chairman Murphy and Chairman Leader, I appreciate the opportunity to address the members today. I've got a brief statement I'd just like to read.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for this opportunity to address today's release of the Joint Committee report. MnDOT appreciates the hard work and the good intentions that have gone into this report. Earlier this week, a select group of MnDOT employees were given access to a draft of the report, so we, like you, are seeing the final document for the first time today. The limited review afforded to MnDOT is different than the more extensive review and comment process normally afforded agencies under audit by the Office of Legislative Auditor. So while we cannot provide substantive comment until we have thoroughly reviewed the report, there are four observations that I would like to offer. First, it must be clearly reiterated that the cause of the I-35W bridge collapse remains unknown. The National Transportation Safety Board is the expert federal agency in this matter, and they are conducting a thorough and objective investigation. The NTSB's conclusion are due sometime near the end of this year. It would be premature to draw any conclusions regarding the cause of the I-35W tragedy prior to release of the report. And I think, as we all noted today, I think we all would all agree that we must continue to defer to the NTSB investigation for the cause of the collapse. Second, I want to assure this committee and the citizens of Minnesota that the bridges throughout our state are safe and sound. MnDOT's inspection and maintenance of state bridges meets or exceeds federal guidelines and standards. Minnesota's bridges consistently rank among the best in the nation. As measured by 2007 federal statistics, Minnesota ranks fourth best in the nation and tops in the Midwest in the low percentage of bridges rated structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, with Minnesota's percentage nearly one-half the national average. The February 2008 Legislative Auditor's Report noted that between 2002 and 2006, the overall structural condition of state trunk highway bridges improved. The number of structurally deficient highway bridges was reduced, and MnDOT met its aggressive performance targets for structures in good condition. Furthermore, under Governor Pawlenty's initiative, the accelerated inspections of all MnDOT bridges was completed in December of 2007, and MnDOT is exceeding federal guidelines in our continuing efforts to conduct engineering reviews and visual inspection of gusset plates on existing truss bridges. My third point. MnDOT's commitment to the safety of Minnesota bridges is a top engineering investment priority. As was repeatedly stressed in interviews with the Great Plant Moody attorneys who crafted this report, addressing the condition and safety needs of our bridge system has never been and never will be subject to question due to budgetary concerns. We rely on and invest in the expert opinions and recommendations of our bridge engineering professionals. Fourth, MnDOT has already embarked on actions to improve processes, policies, and practices related to bridge design, maintenance, and inspection. These efforts are in response to various Federal Highway Administration technical advisories, NTSB recommendations, the recent Legislative Auditor's Report, and internal recommendations from our bridge professionals. These multiple initiatives are outlined in a recent memo provided to the Joint Committee chairs. We believe these improvements will help address many of the recommendations contained in the Joint Committee's report. Chairman and members, MnDOT looks forward to conducting a thorough review of this report. We intend to provide comments to the committee and a written response. And I look forward to coming back, as Senator Murphy suggested, to provide more detailed response to the report. And I do agree, as I've been suggested around the table here, that we really do have to work towards a strong transportation community, and we need to work together to do that, and that is one of my goals as commissioner. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sorrell, and once again, our committee's looking at the process. We're not engineers except for Senator Carlson, and
Leader.
Oh, and Representative Leader, who actually wrote the CASA formula back in 1958. 1956? Oh, that was before either you and I were even a twinkle in anybody's eye. That was a long time ago. But and you know, we don't have those engineering the understanding of the engineering on how bridges are put together and designed outside of these two folks here. And we appreciate the education that we've gotten from MnDOT, and we do look forward in working together to make sure that we continue to have a good bridge program, as I said earlier, and hopefully the best one any place in the world. So, again, thank you, Commissioner, and thank Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to emphasize that some of the points you just raised are it's important for the public to understand, for MnDOT and everyone gathered in this room to understand. Our sole goal, as articulated repeatedly by Representative Hortman and others, is to restore the confidence in MnDOT and to work cooperatively and productively with MnDOT. I think the critiques and the criticisms that come forward in this report are also directed at the legislature, at our larger political culture, and the executive branch. And so we all share some responsibility in responding to the findings in this report. This is not a political errand that we're on at all. And I think Gray Plant Moody will validate and verify that we told them to do, they were completely independent, to do what they had to do. Mm-hmm. We had virtually no contact with them of substance throughout the investigation, asked them to let the facts lead us where they need to lead us. And there was no prior direction. I think they've done an excellent job of doing that. I think the expertise of their firm really comes shining forward. We had a bipartisan, very cooperative process in selecting them. They're a bipartisan firm. And I think we have a bipartisan response to the findings. And so mm-hmm. I'm pleased with what we have here, and I'm really interested in getting to work on this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Dibble. No further comment. The committee is adjourned. Yeah, I'm going to take my... I'm not going to stay very long. It's right down here.
Oh.
Then again, I'm not...
There's plenty of... No, I'm not...